said is to sit here until the earliest 5 o'clock. The earliest 5 o'clock, because the committee is supposed to take a briefing from the minister and his team, Minister Nam, as the committee. We, in our prior discussion with the minister, we agreed that perhaps you said we have you have a very long presentation, so you won't be going through the presentation, but you're going to talk to the presentation and then allow for members to engage with yourself. So without wasting time, the floor is yours. We can walk us through the perspective.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Indeed, the presentation is very long. Not long enough to lose on a day like today, but it is a long presentation. And I'd like to start from the premise that all of the issues are reasonably fresh in the minds of members of the committee, partly because people participated in the lockup yesterday with nothing else to do but the discipline of them wading through the documents they think the idea is essential. So I will spare the committee the pain of going through it once again. You don't need to see the numbers, you know the numbers. Perhaps know them better than what I do sitting here, but I want to perhaps just talk about the context within which the budget is made. And that is a global environment that is significantly different from that last year. And this is a feature of the entire world now. The U.S. economy, I saw that they released, the Fed released a new growth forecast yesterday, but it doesn't have a lot of credibility because the view outside of the Fed in the U.S. at the moment is that they will have a recession this year. But part of it, I mean, was occasioned by the subprime crisis and the consequence of just the subprime crisis is now seen. $400 billion $400 billion of write-downs by the banks, confirmed by the G7 finance ministers when they met just under 2 weeks ago. That is a huge amount of money. But in looking at that as write-downs, there are a series of other issues that are also likely to impact, including certain transactions that have been in the pipeline that now can't be financed that would have an impact on growth going forward. And secondly, the essential glue that has held together a banking system for centuries has been interbank trust to facilitate interbank loans. And there's so little trust because there's no sense of what the balance sheet is, and this is having an impact in the short term. Clearly, those waves are spread right across North America, but also into Europe, where they're living through their own banking crisis. And this past Sunday, the chair saw the Chancellor of the Exchequer announce the nationalization of Northern Rock, a huge mortgage lender in the UK. France is living through the difficulties of what has happened with SocGen, with a rogue trader and too little oversight. Germany is looking much better, but growth across Europe is still pretty low. Inflation has taken hold very strongly. As you move right across into Japan, the same kind of trends are in evidence. The world was hoping that the continued dependence on China and India would lift it, but you know, in some respects, China is facing its own difficulties. the infrastructure constraint kicking very, very strongly with the change of weather that has seen huge difficulties in energy supply, the inflation number to December last year was 7.1%. And if you try and understand the scale of the change, it was, what was the number we looked at? 1.8 in the previous year. 1.8 in the year to December 06. 7.1 in the year to December 07 is a very, very, very significant change in the inflation rate in a single country. The impact of a slowdown in the U.S., given the extent that China is dependent on that market for the export of all manner of commodity goods, is going to have a profound impact on China going forward. They are revising their growth numbers downwards. The number that people are looking at the moment is 9.5%, but it's unlikely to be the final number. India will revise their numbers downwards. The minister will present his budget to Parliament next Wednesday, and there will be a further downward revision. In that environment, it's unlikely that we could be safe. We revised our number downwards to 4%, and that is the number that we were in. Now, that 4% might not accord with the worst fears that some people called economists, and it certainly doesn't accord with this new category of people created by the media called economic analysts, whatever they may be. They dream up things and they don't have to use numbers or anything, but it's okay. The 4% is a number we are making a commitment on, and that 4% is important for us because it means that we have the key variable that determines our revenue number. And I think, Chair, you and members of this committee will know that the under-collection of revenue is not a risk that we would be prepared to take. I mean, I'd hate to be in a position where come December, that MPs want to go on holiday or campaign or do whatever, we now have to convene a special meeting of Parliament because it doesn't look like we can collect enough revenue. To try and then do something on the eve of a budget would be exceedingly difficult. On the eve of an election would be extremely difficult. So, given the political cycle and given everything else, we would not take a risk of it. So we stand by a 4% number. We think it's a well-based number. We would envisage that there would be a consensus somewhere around that number in the not too distant. The other issue that has happened in the global market is that capital markets have tightened quite considerably. It's not going to be a very pleasant place to try and borrow with very tight spreads and long term, which is why we need to take account of the circumstance and minimize it. The third issue is that gap in our investment equation. We have savings to GDP of 14%, and we have an investment to GDP of 21%. And unless you know a different form of mathematics, the one is not equal to the other. That gap of 7% is our worry. That gap is the current account deficit. That gap needs to be financed by foreign savings. And that foreign savings comes in a variety of different forms of investment. And so we need to be mindful of that as we take the next. That intention is the background against which we firstly opted for the fiscal posture that we have, maintaining a surplus, but also ensuring that to the best of our ability, the spending plans can be financed. Apart from the increases, the significant changes are in the area of social development, where in the social security grants, the first step towards age equalization in the social old age pensions for men kicks in as soon as the legislation is passed and the regulations, and hopefully that might start in April. And secondly, in discussion with the Department of Social Development, there is the need to change certain things. I mean, some independent research indicates that the means test is not working, and almost half of the recipients of child support grants should not be getting the grant. So one of the changes that needs to happen there is a significant change to the way in which the means test is applied. And secondly, a rollout then to age 15 with a focus on eligibility criteria that may be entirely new, but we would look to countries like Mexico and Brazil and Chile to look at how they apply this to see whether those same eligibility criteria are in place. So you say to people, sure, the state will not abandon you, we will not leave you to your own devices, we are mindful of the extent of poverty, but it can't just be without requiring of you to do anything. If you, as a parent, would like us to support your child, your indigent child, then we would ask of you to send the child to school. And we would know that your child is in school, because when such a child stops going to school, then the grant will come in. This requires a very different form of administration that we need to get in place, which is why amongst the reasons why there is a deferral of the implementation of that to January of next year. For the rest, I think on conditional grants, the areas including the hospital revitalization and so on have been strengthened. But in broad terms, I think that against any measure we can indicate that the spending side is strong. There are also, and we've added 116 billion rand over the last budget to take our spending then up to 632 billion more or less. It's a very significant growth. The 116, I think, beats even the opposition party who made small calls for what should be added. So we're quite comfortable with that, and I'm sure that there wouldn't be too much debate in this house. The other new expenditure item is of course the commitment that we've made to ESCOM, 60 billion rand over 5 years. We think that the first 20 will be called during this medium-term expenditure framework period, which is why we've built this into the contingency reserve. On the tax side, again, three basic changes. The first of those is the reduction of the corporate rate from 29 to 28. Secondly, the personal income tax relief of 7.2 billion rand. And thirdly, those very significant changes to ease the path and responsibilities of small businesses. For the rest, there would be work of continuation in areas such as SDC. When, as it's terminated, sees the tax liability accrued to the individual the recipient of a dividend or shareholder, as the case may be. And that is just, you know, the continuation of work in progress. That gives us then that gap between spending of 632 and revenue of 650 and a deficit, sorry, a surplus, I keep calling it a deficit, a deficit of minus 0.8, no, a surplus of plus 0.8. The other set of announcements made yesterday, Chair, relate to the effective removal of exchange control and its replacement with a new approach of financial surveillance. That's the story. We think that we've taken account of as much input as we can. Of course, we would disagree with a number of commentators on some of the numbers, some of their observations, but we're standing on solid ground. I should check, sorry, that was a very high-level summary, but I should check whether the DG and the Commissioner would like to add anything.
Okay, thanks.
The DG was not speaking on your behalf. Commissioner. Okay. So, members, we... The presentation the minister was talking to, the full text of the presentation is with the members. So if members have any questions that are in the presentation itself, in any of the documents, in the budget speech, you just have to refer us to the specific document that you are talking to. If the question arises from any of those. But, gentlemen, it sounds like that was a very clear and concise summary. It's now open for discussion. Members. Members are up again. Where is it? Mr. Mgoni, Mr. Maria, Mr. Malota.
Thank you, Chair. I must confess that I've gone through the document, but the bigger questions that I have. However, I've got these two, three questions. First of all, is the issue of the allocation to land. It's 1.5 billion. And knowing that there's still only less than 10% of the land that has been transferred, the figures is not much advantage. And also looking at food security. Food prices increasing now, not say only South Africa, but worldwide. How do you ensure that there will be enough funds? Or do you think that the Minister thinks that they have allocated enough funds to make sure that you transfer at least the target, which is a target of 10% at length to the previous advantage? Honorable Mayor. My second question here is on the issue of electricity. The governor has quite vehemently pronounced against the increase of ESCOM by 18% and the comes to 14%. And yet the document here that advocating that electricity is going to be more expensive. How does the minister kind of reconcile that with the call by the governor that keep inflation down? And if ESCOM could increase electricity, that's going to affect our inflation. And if you are predicting that the inflation will be around 30% and also to increase below the target range of 6% by 2009, do I think you'll achieve that target if what's near there is electricity problem and a possible increase in electricity? My last question is, my last question here is on page 61 of the budget review, the second paragraph. on the corporate tax that has been decreased from 29% to 28%. The second or third question says that this measure is also intended to reduce the cost of capital, possibly increase in private sector investment, stimulating the supply side of the economy. I just want to find out that has this ever happened, and how does the Treasury measure that actually the decrease in this tax will actually affect the changes that the interest is?
Thank you. Thank you, Minister Xi. Our congratulations to the Minister and his staff for the budget yesterday. There's just a few things that one wants to get clarity on. The first one is what I have as the effective surplus. We have got a bigger than expected surplus this year. The revenue is higher. And then you have budgeted for about 8.5 billion rand budget surplus for the next financial year. If I add the contingency amount of starting with 6 but growing to 20 billion rand, it means that within a year we've got an effective surplus of 80 billion rand. That seems to be a fast accumulation of that. And the contingency budget mentions about unexpected or unknown expenditures. It seems like a huge amount to provide for unknown or unexpected expenditures. If you can clarify that one as the first point. Then the second one is about stimulation for foreign direct investment specifically. You quite rightly said that the gap is just getting too big. The deficit is getting too large, and we need to be more export orientated. Now, whilst we appreciate the fact that there's been 5 billion rand set aside to the Department of Trade and Industry and for the industrial development projects, that we don't pick up a specific message to foreign direct investors to come and invest and create jobs in a sustainable way. Maybe you can clarify that, and with that, obviously the abolishment of the foreign exchange control is fantastic, but it's been replaced by certain limits. Do you see that as a restrictive factor, or do you see that a business can very easily overcome that? And then, Mr. Chair, the last point of question that I've got at this stage is the allocation of funds to the different departments are very brave and I think it's very bold. The one thing that we don't pick up, because we know that there is more than often not a correlation between the money invested and allocated and the outcomes that we see. It seems like there's not strong measures that we pick up to make sure that money gets managed and spent effectively and goal-orientated. In other words, not spending for the sake of spending, but get the outcomes that is intended with those budgets. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir. Am I ready? Chair, my first question relates to the fact that there's going to be a net negative voting requirement for the BMSM framework. Now, I just want to find out, because that can also translate into low supply of bonds in the bond market, local bond market. How is government going to ensure that the local bond market is supported, remains liquid, and there's sufficient turnover? My second question would be on, I just want to find out what was the rationale for you to reject the notion of the flow through share incentive that was suggested last year, and opted for the 50% deduction for investment engineer mining exploration company. My last question, Chair.
The minister is very optimistic that our inflation rate will be within target next year. We are moving from 7, I think, to 4.9. But my question is, if you look at the factors that are driving inflation in South Africa, the oil price, food price, constraints within the economy, I just want to get an explanation from the minister. How do you see all these factors in a way decreasing, I mean, the downside risk decreasing to the point of inflation coming to that level?
Okay, let's take those three for now. We'll see whether they are more.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thanks for the question. The land issue is, of course, a rather challenging issue. Challenging because you can actually trigger enormous speculative activity. I mean, a lot of the difficulties that the Land Claims Commission is having is about the settlement of price. And if tomorrow I got up and said, well, here's 100 billion rand, go spend it, you will find that every hectare of land in this country would have a price acceleration of about 10 times. It's just basic in that. Now, one of the issues that we would also evaluate is the ability of departments to meet their commitments. And in the context of land, there are challenges because we are dealing with a quasi-legal system. And so it can't just be money thrown at the department. Some of what will be dealt with in the new year relates to settlements of restitution claims of 3, 4, 5 years ago. This is an ongoing issue, especially where you have a proper adjudication process. I think the target is a fairly difficult one, but it is necessary to maintain a focus on that whilst understanding that the speed is not just determined by the Department of Land Defense. The second issue is that it's not just restitution and redistribution, but also converting that otherwise dead asset into an enterprise, which is called the agriculture, which is called agriculture. I mean, you can't just inherit land and then farm. It needs some support, some approach, failing which you just bankrupt everybody. So you don't get food security in that way either. A lot will depend on the quality of intervention that comes from the agricultural sector. And this is why members of this committee and other committees should look at the budget for land affairs, should look at the provincial, especially the conditional grant cap, and look at the redistribution grant and the agricultural support mechanism. And if they are out of alignment, all that you do is you transfer land, but that transfer in itself doesn't give the land the value that you would get from placing it under cultivation. Those are challenges, but you know, I think that taking all of these issues into account, we can say that on the 3 billion rand for restitution and almost 3 billion rand for land reform are welcome to the members. The electricity price is a rather interesting. Whilst the inflation target is very important as an anchor for monetary policy. It's very important that we don't turn this thing into a totem pole that we pray before. We must ask the Monetary Policy Committee to maintain the discipline that it has, and as I said in the speech yesterday, we must commend the governor for that firm hand. It doesn't always please us as individuals, but from a macroeconomic perspective, his firm hand is very important. But what has happened in electricity is that there's been a very steady decline in the real value of the cost of energy over a long period. I mean, we have the world's cheapest energy now, but in real terms, in 1989-1990, the average price, the real price, cents per kilowatt hour was 22.07 cents, and it's 13.31 cents. Now, the truth of the matter is that money doesn't pay for the cost of generation and transmission. Amongst the commodity prices that have changed very rapidly, is of course coal price. Now, if Eskom cannot even recover its costs, who then will pay for it? Of course you're going to have to. So, you know, there may be step changes from time to time. The cost of electricity accounts for 3.55% of the total basket we use to measure inflation, and so it's the increase within that you have to watch. But you know, it's almost inevitable that there will be significant price changes in the rate per kilowatt hour for electricity, because it is so severely underpriced. And we don't care, so we also produce all of these emissions, and so those matters will have to change. I'm going to ask either the DG or perhaps the commissioner to deal with the decrease in corporate tax rate. Let me deal with the DG can deal with. Why don't you deal with that, Commissioner? The DG can deal with the contingency reserve. You can also prepare DG to deal with maybe the borrowing requirements, Commissioner, the flow through versus the incentive. Then I can pick up the rest. No. There are other people out working. The head of the budget office is sitting in the corner, hopefully one person. Okay.
Yeah, other people can just volunteer themselves to respond to some of the questions that might be relevant to their areas of work.
So we'll pick up the
third
chair and volunteer them on their behalf.
Okay.
On the CIT chair, the minister has always maintained that if we broaden the tax base and get better compliance, so we will get lower rates, and both on the personal side and on the corporate side, that's happened during his tenure as the minister. I think the question was, do we get private sector investment? That again is an appeal that he's made constantly, that he challenges the private sector. If you do get these cuts, will you invest? I'm going to ask for some help from my economist friends, but I imagine that the measure of gross fixed investment in South Africa is one indication, and it has grown substantially over the last few years, that the private sector as well as the public sector is indeed investing. EU compliant, because there's still money that we could find if we look for it hard enough. And from that point of view, the minister has been able to keep his promise. It was one of the economists who backed me up on the measurement.
No, I'm an economic analyst.
Now I'm independent.
No, I think that there is a direct link for us to estimate exactly how much quantum investment will change as a result of the cut in the corporate tax rate. It requires us to do some serious econometric work, but we do know that by affecting changes to the cost of capital via the tax rate, it does stimulate investment. That is one sort of issue. That has to do with the fact that our take from corporate taxes has moved from something like 15% of our total tax paid to around 24%. Now that's good. Problem is, corporate taxes can be quite volatile because they depend on the business cycle. You would be introducing volatility in your own revenue chain. An adjustment was necessary. And I'm saying that even as we cut the corporate tax rate, our tax rates, headline tax rates, are not out of line with the countries that our businesses normally prefer to compare us. The standard of issues that was raised had to do with the public sector borrowing requirement. It was negative in the current fiscal year, but it is growing quite strongly in the outer 3 years of the MTR. And the reason is not hard to find. It has to do with an acceleration in investment program mainly the state-owned enterprises. I guess the more important question here that Honorable Mulato is raising is, if you have got negative borrowing, what is the impact on the bond market? We have tried to make sure that you do not destroy the bond market, that you retain this bond market, because the thing about bond market is that you need to measure them. You might be running a surplus now and feeling that you do not quite need the bond market. But one day the cycle will turn and you will have to go to the bond market, and you better make sure that you will find it still functional. What we have been doing has been a range of debt management activities to make sure that they continue to increase in the South African bond market. So you would have seen that we entered into switch options, switching out of bonds that are maturing into longer dated bonds, consolidating some of the bonds into few liquid benchmarks that are tradable. So far, it didn't look like the negative net borrowing requirement had had an adverse effect on the bond market. As a matter of fact, turnover has increased during the current fiscal year from around 10 trillion rand to just over 11 trillion rand. And then, just to make sure that we do not have a fruitless expenditure, Kuben will answer the question about the contingency reserves to make sure that you can justify why he's here.
If you also deal with the question of the inflation.
Okay, Kuben. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Let me start off by paying for my trip by correcting the minister. The amount that budgeted for land reform over the next 3 years is about 10 billion rand, not three. In fact, the budget goes from 1.5 billion to 4.1 billion, 1.5 billion in 2007-8 to 4.1 billion by 2010-11.
I don't know what that does to guaranteeing your career, but okay, go ahead and let's deal with the.
No, I was talking of the appropriations in the first year.
Go ahead.
Thank you, man. Thank you, Chair. The contingency reserve, there's 38 billion rand worth of money in the contingency reserve over the 3 years. It's incorrect to interpret that as part of the surplus. This is money that government is budgeting to spend or setting aside for contingencies for possible spending. In the second and third year, it's a policy reserve that's drawn down to fund ongoing policy priorities. So it's incorrect to add that to the surplus. From that 38 billion, we've said that about 20 billion will go to ESCOM. And so there's a significant portion of that that's already earmarked. We've also said from that 38 billion that over the 3 years, about 2 billion rand will go to support energy intensive. Any investment in energy efficiency, in renewable energy and so forth. On the capacity to spend, I mean, there has been a significant improvement in the capacity to spend, especially on infrastructure. The budget review reports that we spent 93% of the capital budget last year. That was an improvement. At the provincial level, it was close to 99%. That's a significant improvement. So yes, there's still one or two areas where capacity to spend is a concern, but the general overall impression is that there's an improvement in the capacity to spend, a steady improvement. On inflation, it is true that in 2007, or in the early part of 2007, the increase in inflation was mainly driven by higher food prices and higher fuel prices. However, in the second half of 2007, it's also clear that inflationary pressures have spread. There's been what they call second round effects, and there's been a much broader increase in inflationary pressures. I think we estimated that about three quarter of the inflation basket, or the items in the inflation basket, have increased over the period. And so it's not just fuel and food that are driving inflation today. It's much broader, and therefore it can't just be interpreted as an exogenous shock that we can allow to recede. You do need to be vigilant because there are second-round effects, and those second-round effects have already come into the economy. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. The other questions from Mr. Maria, the issue of foreign direct investment is always a very tricky subject, partly because it needs to be informed by certain choices in industrial policy. Mainly. You know, I have no doubt that it comes. But once it comes, there are always issues that need to be valued in the context of dividend flow and royalties and all kinds of things. But the key issue is that you need to target those that will maximize employment, bring new technology, and as far as possible, bring capital in. Because some foreign direct investors come and set up everything with very little employment, but all of their borrowing is done domestically. So it kind of defeats the purpose. So this is why these issues have to be worked at in the detail and in the instance rather than just generically.
on the what I call the paper in the nine issues of exchange control, you know, if the key issue to evaluate is of course the institutional investors, and I don't believe that this is restrictive. Every country in the world that I know, I'm sure there are some that I don't know, but those that I know of have prudential requirements for institutional investors. And there's a basic formula that says you apply for a license to manage money on behalf of other people. In granting you the license, you accept first, well, you'd be evaluated for complying with the standards of being fit and proper. And once licensed, there are certain requirements with which you have to comply. Declarations would be some of those, and meeting certain prudential standards would be another. If you don't want to comply with that, then you can't manage other people's money. Because you shouldn't ask people to give their money to somebody whose last job was selling manure or something and now sits with lots of billions and doesn't know what to do. It's a very, very dicey business. People can't mess around with their savings, pensions, and so on. You know, I'm of the view that if Gomez Morais has lots of his own money inherited and accumulated and wants to blow, that's easy dabba. But if you are licensed to invest other people's money, then the rules must be also applied. Because if you don't do that, and if you're large enough, then you can have systemic risk. And I invite the honorable member to look at the matter of Mr. Kervin in the context of shock chain to understand what the impact of something like that could be. No, we have to have regulations for institutional investors, and I truly don't believe that these are restrictive or will be any more restrictive than what you have now. We have, in fact, a great responsibility to ensure that whilst the focus is on the new Financial Surveillance Department of the Reserve Bank, between that and the Financial Services Board, we need to be able to jack up our efforts so that you aren't faced with delays. The responses can be immediate. Where action needs to be taken, that can be immediate. Where there are problems with the audits or the submissions, you have to deal with these issues straight away, failing which bad people take the money of innocent and honest people and do terrible things, as we've seen in this country also. You asked the question about Parliament and the oversight. No, you didn't. Why did I hear you say
that? In his question, I think that was going to be your response with regard to the outcomes versus the allocation.
Okay. No. I think I want to again say, Chair, what we can't do as the family of the finance ministry is to supervise everything that happens. We can say that the process that departments have been through to be granted the allocation here is quite a rigorous process. But we've granted. Now that the allocations are made, it's very important that we confirm that whilst, you know, there might still be debates about the procedure to amend money votes, if Parliament doesn't like the allocations, it's the right of Parliament to say, go and do it again. Parliament has never done this, but it's the right of Parliament to do it. Hopefully we can hear each other in a room like this and see if we can remake it and bring it back, but it's the right of Parliament. But once Parliament has passed this and appropriated the money, when the law has been passed after the scrutiny and analysis by Parliament, then that law must be obeyed. And we don't have speed cameras or traffic cops or things like that. We can only ask Parliament to increase its vigilance. What we do is to publish monthly as both, if you wish, actual expenditures in terms of Section 32 of the PMMA. We do it and we say to Parliament, there it is, let's see you use this stuff. And that interrelationship is a fundamentally important one. So you don't have to wait until the Audit General is concluded. Audit and Scopa deals with this thing in successive years. You can and should deal with it in here. And that is the power that Parliament has. I think it's an untested power. It's an untested power, but it's a phenomenally strong power that the law and the Constitution give Parliament. So I'm saying it's there. It's there, and we ask you, please, earn your salary. Thanks.
Okay, if all the questions have been responded to, we are going to... Have they not? Which one has left? The flow through share incentive?
Yeah.
Yeah. Commissioner?
Chair, on that, essentially, our colleague, John Tetley himself, did some international benchmarking on the flow through share concept on the one hand, and on the other hand, looked at other demands for support for venture capital initiatives in South Africa, and thought from that analysis that the flow through shares were difficult to administer in our context, and there were advantages in going through the scheme that you have now for both mining and non-mining.
Okay, when I walked in here, Minister, one young man asked me whether, now that we have revised our projected GDP growth, are we then saying that we are also revising down on our achievement of the MDG goal? He wanted an answer from me. I said this session will answer that because of the Minister.
Chair, the MDG goals is in part a question of the amount of money that we budget for the services, and in part it's the execution of the task. Now, the MDG goal of universal primary education should be quite easy. Yeah? We're asking Parliament to appropriate 121 billion rand for education in this new year. That's a lot of money. But unless you have teachers in class teaching, and unless you work at constructing an environment for learning and teaching, and unless you hold the schools accountable through school governing bodies to local communities, unless all of those things are in place, you might not be able to attain the MDG goal, notwithstanding the fact that it's not a money problem. I think similarly in health. If we look at all of the health issues, maternal mortality, infant mortality, it goes through all of the MDG targets, and ostensibly on the amount of money available, we should do that as part of our normal health system. But there are some setbacks. I think one of the areas where the measures are worrisome is in the area of maternal mortality. And also infant mortality, yes. Now you can go back through the system and look at the wherewithal, look at the construction of clinics, look at the other elements in the primary health care system, including provision of safe potable water and sanitation. Then you can look at all of those investments and see that they are being made because there are full gaps in the system. It's not a money problem. Even the downward revision to 4% of GDP growth is not a money problem. The 116 billion rand we're adding to the expenditure envelope should more than adequately cover all of the MDG goals. It's a management. And that is why not just the discussions in Parliament, but the knowledge of what happens in constituencies is as important to ensure that the management issues are dealt with. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Singh, Mr. Johnson, Mr. Gourney, Mr. Lodge, Dr. George, I just want to know if they have
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you, Minister. Colleagues, a well-presented budget. In October last year, when we were having a similar kind of discussion, where you were present, Mr. Minister, some of us expressed concern about the possible double-digit increases on electricity tariffs, especially for the consumer. And a specific question was put to Treasury. Is Treasury considering additional funding to ESCOM? And the answer at that time, on the 31st of October, was there's been no request from ESCOM for additional funds. And the general view is that ESCOM has a healthy balance sheet. And if there is there any expansion programs that are on the cards, then they will be able to fund it out of the balance sheet. Well, a lot of water has flown under the bridge in the last 3 months, and we see that almost 60 billion rand is being set aside to assist ESCOM in the expansion program over the next 5 years. Now, on page 53 of the budget review, some of the programs are listed there. So the question is, you know, is the minister satisfied that the expansion programs envisaged by ESCOM will allow us to see the light at the end of the tunnel, and also will not continue to put undue pressure on consumers of electricity, particularly the poor consumers who are now only coming onto stream using electricity in the rural areas and other areas? And I'm sure the Minister and his team have looked at the proposal of ESCOM, but what are the principles that are going to underlie the granting of this funding to assist ESCOM in the expansion program? Secondly, Mr. Minister, second question is on biodiversity management, and this is on page 66 of the review, and I think it's a very welcome proposal that there will be some tax reforms and some incentives to encourage the conservation of South Africa's rich biodiversity. But I'd like to know whether this will be unpacked and rolled out by the Department of Environmental Affairs and Tourism, or what's the thinking, broad thinking, on how this will roll out to people who are environmentally conscious. And lastly, Mr. Minister, I know it's a question of numbers, and when I say to you that we would have liked to see the disability grants and the old age grants be 1,000 rand, you would say, why not 1,100, or why not 950? But 1,000 seems to be some kind of a magical figure.
What
Well, then we go over the threshold of 1,000. I knew you would come with that response. But given the cost of food and the food inflation and things like that, I mean, was it not possible to consider a bigger increase in social grants than the 940 rand that is being proposed?
Mr. Johnson?
I guess the question that is this. What is the rationale for us to say this increase instead of the other increase, whether it is based on any CPIS rate or not? Those are some of the questions I would imagine. My wish to ask. But mine would be on two specific areas. there is a competition as we go on with our development in our country between agriculture and development. To an extent, you know, whilst we compete with a program of having to coverage retribution and the target there being 30%, competing demands on development are equally coming on board. To an extent, you might even wish to seriously engage on that one as to how best do we see a solution out of that situation. The last one for me directly related to social sector. Saving methods in our country for me is a question as to whether are they effective. We have a number of those from pension to retirement, provident funds and so on. For those who are in formal employment situations, there are of course other proposals that are there initiated by government, whether it's taking bonds or stocks and so on and so forth, and some of the issues like cooperative banks. Whether we shouldn't find a measurement that we need to put in place that should look into success stories so as to be able to see whether we are making progress or not. We keep on talking about a problem that our country is having of having not to be saved. Now, these are some of the issues that I would be quite keen on and for us as we move forward talking about savings in our country we need to look into. And then, of course, one of the issues that is encountered by media is that you are having here a minister who was to be working on a very tight rope between pursuing, you know, government program or having to pursue Polokwane resolution. I simply did not see much of any conflict there. And these are issues that are really being faced in as time goes. As the minister would have said earlier on, these are plans that have been there afoot from your medium-term budget policy statement. If there could be a comment on those.
Thank you. Just as a follow up on the inflation and the land issue. China is on the 17th of January put a price cap on food, on all food. Because of the inflationary pressures that the food has on the inflation, and also the Central People's Bank of China has raised its requirement for bank requirements because also it wants to cap the inflation that is it has in China. Coming to South Africa. Is there any point that you might think of putting a price cap on food? Because if you subsidize some of the food or exonerate some of the food, the poor still, the user is only the risk that takes the benefit. And is possible, or as the minister said, you can throw money on the land issue, but as long as the processes are not done on the ground, you're still going to have the problem. Can't you perhaps put a price cap on land issue that the state can purchase the land with so much more than that, then we have to either take the land in the Zimbabwe way. My third question is the offset of the development assistance. 10 billion later, about 10 billion rand was donated to South Africa or given to South Africa as ODA. How much of that amount is helping us as far as the budget is concerned, or as far as South Africa reaching its own goals. We know that it has got some conditions, but how much can actually assist us? We have a free hand on. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to refer Mr. Sutton to the minister to speak finally the budget issue, where he says that the South Africans currently about fourth participation rate of 6.2%, which is lower than rates in African countries that is currently being negotiated. I just want to find out what's the deal, so what's the problem, given our level of development, that maybe there's something that I have. My second question is on the Close Health Company. Close Health Company, so Health Company. You have mentioned, I just lost the page, where you say they will be taxed at 40%. My question is, do we have that type of animal rate, of a closed rate company that wants to be taxed at a lower tax rate of 28.9, and whether in the process are we not going to have ordinary family business? My last question says on the issue of tariffs. The minister in budget speech, page 5, is saying that various countries export growth is due to certain transport capacity constraints, high telecommunication costs, and tariffs that raise the type of importance intermediate and secondary goods. I just want to establish whether any exercise was done in government to try to identify this intermediate and secondary goods that we care a high tariff as a result to sort of lower our competition.
Can we perhaps proceed those as soon as want to form our hands? Let's perhaps take responsibility as well.
Thanks, Chair. Indeed, the situation was, as we advised the committee, in relation to ESCOM in October last year. There was no request. And again, it's necessary to restate the position, because somehow there's been misinformation about it. What happened in ESCOM is not that anybody forgot to budget for ESCOM's needs. Because since 1923, ESCOM has not been the kind of body as a government department would require transfers. The only money that we paid via ESCOM was for electrification and not for the capital program. So indeed it was an unusual request. I think that over the next few weeks there will be very intensive discussion, certainly about the first 60, but also about the bold program. I mean, yeah, ESCOM, I suppose, is finding itself in a bit of a difficulty because, you know, it doesn't have any inherent. In its history, it has announced its responsibility of what the consumers pay. That has been the central principle on which this is being marked, called ESCOM, was developed. Part of the difficulty in the gap was an idea that thought that new generation capacity should be left to the private sector.
the private sector is not always given to these long-term investments because you can't build the power station and expect to recoup your investment in the space of a few weeks. Large parts of this enormous electrification infrastructure is sunk, amortized, and therefore the financial cost thereof are substantially different. Notwithstanding that there's a gap between cost of production and cost of sales. And if Eskom were a company where the cost of sales is continually below the cost of production, we know what would happen. The principle of consumers paying for Eskom is one that we would fight to retain in the system, because it certainly is a good approach to financing. There might be short-term issues, but that is the position that we must return to in the shortest space of time. As that happens, and I want to be perfectly frank about this, it's very unlikely that we will return to this position where our energy costs are so far off the global curve. The present situation is not sustainable. There will have to be increases in the price of electricity. Part of what we don't know, I'm saying, is what kind of increases the regulator would permit. Because that will have an impact then on revenues, the speed of the build program. It would give an indication to the balance sheet and may impact on the cost of borrowing. These are matters of detail that we would ask this House to understand, that we have to work through almost line by line. And give honorable members the assurance that the discussions between Eskom and the Treasury are likely to be tougher than the discussions between Eskom and banks. Is that fair? I think it's the only way we can resolve the issue. The biodiversity rollout, that the Commission has been talked to that. On the the extra 60 rand that the Honourable Singh, and it's very important to raise the question that the Honourable Johnson raised. I don't know what's based on, apart from sentiment. I mean, why is 1,000 rand a sexier number than 940 rand? I mean, what does it show that the other one doesn't? An increase that may prove to be unaffordable. We've got to try and manage. I mean, the position that we must get to in the shortest space of time is a mandatory, contributory retirement scheme for all workers. That's where we're heading to. That's the work in progress. That's the social security reform that Andrew Donaldson is leading at the intergovernmental level. But until then, you know, these are not options. People say to me, how do you expect us to live off this, that, or the other? I mean, I know it's a very difficult issue. I know it's an exceedingly difficult issue. I can remember way back when there was a minister called Jean Lowe who said pensioners should be able to live on 15 grand a month.
Yeah, that's a pretty
long. Was it love of living?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't want to go there. Clearly, don't want to go there. But there are very difficult set of balances that we have to undertake, and so it's a very tough call. the issues of land and development, I mean, you know, what we can't do in the budget on Bill Johnson is to fund things that aren't developed. The agrarian reform, the agrarian development program is fundamentally important. I don't think it's an optional exercise. I don't know that you can necessarily say that it works to keep people in the rural areas, but it needs to be properly considered. I mean, you know, we have a litany of approaches, including the Integrated Sustainable Rural Development Strategy. Yeah, I could even say it's a difficult word it is. And so on. That we're intended to deal with these issues. But I think MPs must talk about the outcomes. If it's a costed, developed, and we'd be happy to participate in that process, then it's easy to take it forward. I don't say around your next question, what was it? Huh? Oh, you can deal with that. Well, I think the one big answer. No, the one big answer is mandatory returns. Contributory mandatory returns. It's not asking people to open a post-bank account. It's actually considerably different, and I think that countries that have schemes like those, and perhaps the most recent story of change in an economy is Australia, where that approach and the superannuations built in there and so on has actually changed the pool of investment capital available to Australians. And the last 10 years has been very significant in this regard. Now, I don't know where the difference is. It's not as though Uncle Johnson that, you know, anything different came in Polokwane. You know that. I mean, I said to the press yesterday that we sent out, I think the Tete Khaniyahu spoke to his meeting counterparts somewhere in the middle of November to tell them what the letter would be that I would send them on the allocation. And by the time I sent the letters towards the end of November, ministers were already calling me up to ask why we were being so mean-spirited and so on. So, you know, long before Polokwane, the allocation letter has gone out already. There isn't a contradiction. I mean, there's a rollout of continuity of policy and program. But I don't believe that there ever will be a contradiction. What is even more encouraging is that I've read and listened to comments made by opposition parties in this meeting. And I'm trying to find the gaps. I mean, it's good when in a country like ours we all understand what the challenges are, regardless of the parties that we represent here, Chairperson. And then we say, let's do these things together, and I don't know many countries in the world where you can have as high a level of consensus about the challenges before us as we have, and I want to express my appreciation to all members of this committee, because it makes a very considerable difference. We don't have to then fight issues that don't need fighting about, and we can concentrate on the implementation of these. Honorable Nguni had asked about price caps. Now, I'll tell two stories. The one is one that happened in this committee 4 years ago. VAT on kerosene was lifted 14%, should have accrued to the users of kerosene, primarily the poorest in South Africa. And I think this committee concluded that notwithstanding the measure, they should have seen the advantage go to the end user. That hasn't happened.
And the second story is the bread story, which I may or may not have told that. Old time, and sometimes I repeat this story. So if I have told it before, forgive me. There's no black and brown bread. Black and white bread is 14%. So brown bread should be 14% cheaper. The milling process of brown flour costs 7% less than that for the refining necessary for white flour. So somewhere between 18% and 21% should be the price differential. Go to your corner cafe, go to the supermarket, and check the price. If there's a 20% price differential, I would be pretty surprised. So if you want the caps, then you must decide how you will implement the caps. I was reading an article the other day about a country not far from here that had price control for bread. And the story said that between the time a loaf of bread ostensibly leaves the store and it gets to somebody's house where it will be consumed, it will change hands 3 times because they'll be hoarding. And every time it changes hands, that person will add a premium to the price. But sometimes you end up with a price change that is almost 2.5 times higher than the ostensibly, the price at which the sale is ostensibly. You need to be able to resolve all of those issues. And in China, yes, I know they can resolve those issues. There are many things that they can do if you have an incredibly strong government that looks into every nook and cranny, that takes tough decisions. If you want the government like that, then say, let's do it. Is it? Then say, right, former senior party member guilty of corruption put before a firing squad. Hey, let's do those things, okay. But I think if you want it, then talk through the issue in its entirety. Otherwise, you hope for a measure that doesn't actually improve the lives of those who the measure is intended to improve. And that I think, carries certain determinants. The ODA, $1.5 billion, is that the number? I think I saw somewhere in the budget review. I couldn't find it again. It was the whoops. The labor participation rate that Andrew will respond to. The closely-held companies commissioner will respond to, and he'll respond to the tariff.
Thank you, Chair. I think the question on OEA was how does it help us? $1.5 billion, maybe a bit more, flows into the country. It's not significant as a percentage of our budget. That's less than 1% of objects and 1% of our budget, so we're not in a position of being fiscally reliant on assistance. But I think if you look at the variety of programs that are supported through these sectors of cooperation agreements, they often involve piloting new initiatives with system building and capacity building, and they play a useful role in that way. Labour force participation of about 52%. Why is labour participation lower in South Africa than in many other countries? That's a very tough question that involves a lot of issues that relate to the history of the evolution of our labour market. We do have, and we measure, and that is a track over time, an expanded and a narrow definition of the labor force. and that is the narrow measure of the labor force. There are 4 or 5 million people who are classified in the labor force survey as discouraged workers who are potentially interested in finding work but are not actively looking for work, and clearly narrowing that gap between the potentially active members of the labor force and those who are employed or actively seeking work has got to be a policy priority going forward. Why are people in these circumstances? I think the answer to that involves several interconnected things. It's partly got to do with the very considerable gap between what we sometimes call the first and the modernized economy and the second economy, and that has got to do with differences and the gap between urban and rural areas, the long history of exclusion of people from the central part of the modern economy, and the relatively high proportion of the population who live in rural areas, which have been historically excluded from participation. It has to do with the spatially inefficient structure of our cities that make it quite expensive to move from places where people live to places where there are jobs, where factories, work opportunities are located. It really also has to do with the mismatches between our education and training systems and job opportunities. And these are all elements that spatial development of the economy, development of our training and education system, changes in the relationship between the urban and rural economy, narrowing the gap between commercial agriculture and informal agriculture. Those are all elements of our long-term development challenges and strategies. One thing to add to that is, and the comparison was made with the population rates in other countries, is we have a comparatively high average age of leaving formal education. So people are often going on to further education or still in school until the age of 23 or 24. And of course, education taking up a larger proportion of the population aged 15 to 60 also reduces the participation rate. And that's not a bad thing, that's a good thing. But it does also come through in those numbers. Tariffs on intermediate goods. Again, there's a great deal to say about this. It's not the core responsibility of the Treasury. The International Trade Commission, ITAC, has that responsibility. Our tariff book now has fewer items on it than it used to, but it's still several thousand. So this is a question that really needs to be addressed in a lot of detail, sector by sector, and in many areas, product by product. And I don't think it would be fruitful for me to try to give an amateurish summary of those issues.
I think it's important to say that there will be the release soon of the investigations done by an international panel on various aspects of the economy. There certainly is one of those papers that looks at this issue in a lot more detail and should be readily available.
Two issues on that. Biodiversity, my colleague from Somerset will address before he deals with the issues of society. And the one I want to address Mr. Mulata's question on the closely held companies. Essentially, we have a difference between the income tax rate of 40% and our corporate rate of 28%. That provides, let's call it, multi people an opportunity to arbitrage and say, I'm actually an individual and I should be declaring whether that person would have been to have been operating a so-called closely held corporation and be taxed at 40% and not 28%.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Chair. On the biodiversity question, there's a very strong linkage, as you'll see from the budget review, with the work that is being done with LEED. I mean, there's a strong linkage with a particular act mentioned there, the National Biodiversity Act, the Protected Areas Act. In order to claim the tax deduction, those have to be approved plans in terms of those acts, demonstrating again the linkage. And if you have a look at page 71, the additional work Treasury will be doing with respect to supporting sustainable development, you will then see that that is being conducted in cooperation with LEED. So there is definitely greater work being done.
Okay. Are there any outstanding questions in this batch? No? Okay. We'll proceed, Dr. George.
Thanks, Chair. I'd like to echo the sentiments of my colleague, congratulating the Ministry on the budget that displays the improvements which we find very, very promising. On page number 16 of the presentation, there's reference to sustainable fiscal policy that ensures reduced pressure on inflation and the cost of capital. The increase in the fuel levy seems to contradict this with its potential impact on inflation. I'd just like to know whether any financial modelling was done on what the impact of the levy would have on inflation, because it's on the way up. And then the second question is, on page 5 of the budget speech, there's reference to the current account deficit. And our research indicates that it continues to widen and that it's probably about 8.1% of GDP at present. And there are barriers to the export growth that are listed in the document, such as the skill shortage. But my question is it not possible that South Africa is just not competitive enough in various sectors of the economy, and that certain steps need to be taken to make it more competitive or encourage it to become more competitive? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. May I also thank Honourable Minister for his presentation on the budget. My first question is OSH LEED. Social grants, OSH social grants for males. We have got disabled men who are permanently disabled, and the unemployed men who are already 60 years. Would it be possible for them to be entered into the program immediately, because I mean they're already disadvantaged, the disabled men and the unemployed. And then the second one about the property rates, has enough research been done in rural areas? Because there are people who are having good looking houses, but they spent their last pennies to build those houses following the experience they had with Jomo Moyo. And then the present rough weather right now, and they may not be able to pay rates because they spend very, very much money they have. And then the third and last one, on page 89 of the Division of Revenue, we've got the agriculture grant, and we have got the performance on the so for 2006 and 2007. It is stated there that there was an amount of 115 million rand which was given to the provinces and how it was spent. Then between that, we've got 2008. There's nothing about 2007 and 2008. Although in the estimate, it's given on page 454 that the amount that was given to the provinces was 451 rand and 1.7 million. But the money spent is not given. Could we have clarity on this? I think so.
Honorable Mashiko.
May I just crave your indulgence, Roman? Is it possible for that question and other questions related to the
Division of Revenue
to hold over a little bit?
We'll flag it
for the Division of Revenue discussion.
No, it's fine.
Yeah, I actually meant to mention that issues relating to the division of revenue. So that's got to be our item on the agenda. Honorable Bishop.
I would like to ask about the non-alignment of priorities between the province and the national department when it comes to addressing the needs, because somehow accountability is lacking, because the funds have gone to the provinces and because of different priorities is somehow not used according to how it was supposed to be used, and the questions that are looked at from the national level. And if there could be a way of knowing that when, for an example, education priority is national, the province will also address the priority, if building of schools or any other priority, so then the achievement can be seen in one uniformly. And the other question goes to the municipality. We were talking about Eskom, but there's a problem here where houses are being built in a certain area, and we found that the municipality doesn't have a license, and the license lies with Eskom. And at the end of the day, those houses are not being occupied because municipality has no right to electrify those houses, and it leads to one problem into another where the houses end up being maybe vandalized, and the problem, these houses are on the register for that municipality, and we seem not to be achieving our objectives because of this license issue problem. If when this money is being given to Eskom, somehow could be done with the electrification of new houses. And my last issue will be on the municipality infrastructure grant, which is too directly referring to my municipality, and I don't think it would be fair to address it today because I haven't received a response up to now after I heard something regarding that issue. I don't think it can be addressed openly here. I'll prefer to address it out of this meeting.
You would prefer to wait for your response if you haven't responded. Okay.
As for the Honourable's question,
it belongs to the
Minister. Fujile will be here in a short while, and as does the presentation. I think all of the issues raised by the Mashiach would be, I think, as they put in there, we will give him the questions when he comes.
Okay. If you could just remember that, you know, if he omits to respond to them, just remind us. Let's move on.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll just raise a few questions based on the fact that you have said the other questions can be raised when Mr. Fuzile is here. And I think I want to capture some of the issues on that part. I wanted to check something with regard to the municipalities in respect to the issue of public sector borrowing. I think in the budget review, we have not touched on that aspect with regard to the municipalities. I want to check to what extent are the municipalities indebted. I'm asking that question mostly because somewhere in the budget review you mentioned that most of the municipalities have to finance their capital expenditures through public borrowing. And I don't know why is it that this is allowed to continue to happen, because we understand the financial position of most of the municipalities. The second question will relate to the bond buyback offer or exchange. I want to check how effective was this program, and then also trying to find out how was the funds that were collected from this exercise channeled into the budget. Some of the priorities that are listed in the budget and even in the State of the Nation address relate to education, health, and other social issues. I want to check that refocus, because like some economists will tell you that in South Africa we don't have a problem of funding for education. We have the problem of strategies that we introduce to ensure that we get the right outcome. But it seems as if all the time we inject cash, inject it all the time. But we don't seem to get it right. I want to check if at all there has been a revisit into the strategies that we have applied. For instance, in general, when we were doing the visit to the schools, we identified that most of the schools, like you'll find that a feeder school is a low-fee school, and then the secondary school that receives the scholars from primary, it is not a low-fee school. And that is the only school that receives the schools from that primary school, which is a low-fee school. Maybe we should check what are the issues there. That we still have to address. At times we don't have textbooks. Textbooks are there in schools, but children cannot take them home to read, because I would suppose that when they are in school, they are with the teacher, they can guide them. But when you go home, you have to revisit what the teacher has told you and taught you. But it's a bit difficult for the learner to be able to interact with that after school. I want to check also on the issue of the scrutiny that you say is being done on the department and the SOEs to make sure that they are able to give quantitative performance. Have you considered that scrutiny when you were allocating the funds? Because I suppose that like Home Affairs received an increase again, but they are still living that problem that they had in the past year. Not really being selective, but it's one of the departments that are still receiving large amounts of money but are not able to deliver what we really desire. I will stop there, Chaperson. Thank you.
Yeah. The norm is two questions, and if members want to go to three, I allow them. But four,
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. A very quick question. It's addition to previous ones that has been asked, one by my colleague on the fuel levy, and he has indicated, you know, the real questions on that. Can the minister maybe just give us some background as to what is the motivation for the fuel levy? Because most certainly it would have a tremendous negative effect on transport costs, and especially the shock that will come to consumers and to business in terms of the road accident fund increase, and obviously the increase in fuel that they expect next month. So that's going to be a harsh one. And then just following on the, there was an indication that there's, in terms of investment in infrastructure, that there's already sizable investment by private sector. I think most of us maybe don't see that yet, and we still see that government being the primary
invested in infrastructure in South Africa, that means roads, water, whatever the case may be. Isn't there something that one can do to stimulate that part of the economy that is all direct investment by private sector in infrastructure and have a public-private partnership instead of that? Thank you very much.
Okay. This month.
Yeah, thanks, Chairperson. Because I read the I want to avoid the risk of asking a question that has been asked, but I checked with the Chairperson. But I will ask a simple one, very simple one. Are we winning the war, Minister, when it comes to fintech? Because when I look at the figures, it shows that more people are continuing to smoke. And the combined revenue from alcoholic beverages is less than revenue of from cigarette and related products. So are we winning the war in that regard? Thanks.
Yeah, let's take responses, Minister.
Chair, on the issue of fuel levy, my understanding of this, I'm happy to be correct by Kulin or anybody else, is that on all of the excises, we try and maintain the tax incidence. Mr. George, I'm responding to you. So I'm saying that we try and maintain tax incidence. I think almost every country does, you accept the principle that a commodity like fuel will be taxed, and you have a norm for the incidence. Then you adjust it from time to time. If you don't effect those adjustments, you create the problem that has occurred with energy, when everybody knows that the price is too low, but because the adjustments haven't been effected over time, the gap then requires step changes of the order of magnitude such as we speak. This is a matter that we gave some attention to some years ago. Franz Thomas Seck was a young man with a big beard, and we looked at this issue. And we drew a distinction between the specific excises that we employ and the ad valorem excises that many countries employ, which means that if the fuel price increases, then the tax rate increases in those countries as well. And we were able to look at this at a time when oil was $10 a barrel. And that wasn't in my grandparents' lifetime. This was during my tenure as Minister of Finance. So, you know, again, I don't think that it has an inflationary impact. I mean, it's a considered, the two have stood there side by side. The general fuel levy, and then the road accident fund. Now, as we indicated yesterday, the road accident fund is a system that is in serious need of attention. And you would have seen in newspapers recently that a foreigner is claiming something in the order of 1.3 billion rand from this fund. But if that is what happens, then this thing will be bankrupt in no time. So how do you fund a very important set of issues
We said therefore that this is unresolved work and Parliament must apply its mind to how it will drive those changes. And then also I think going forward the way in which this fund is part of social security generally would be accommodated. It hasn't been possible to deal with everything simultaneously, but it is on the schedule to be addressed. On the question of the current account deficit, there's an interesting story out of Australia, it seems a pretty standard response, because if you look at the current account position, Australia has had a current account deficit of around 6% forever. And the stock response in Australia is, everybody used to winch, they used a different word, about this thing. Every time analysts get together, they talk about it, journalists talk about it. And we just decided that the Australian Reserve Bank stopped talking about it. We wouldn't answer questions about it anymore. And then everybody stopped writing about it, talking about it. Now we live with it. So we don't go into sackcloth and ashes about the current deficit. That's the Australian view, but I hear you. It's more than the issue of the deficit. It's also about the base of the industry. And it's about the fact that if you don't do certain things regularly, then you're overtaken by time and circumstance. You know, we had edge in some sectors before China got there. And then you kind of sit back and rest in your laurels. But competitive advantage is not a permanent position, because others are running to catch up with you, and in so doing, the momentum carries them way past you. And it's understanding those kinds of challenges in the industrial policy environment. The good-looking gentleman to match the good-looking houses, Mumford, has come now. In fact, two of them have come, Mr. Brown and Mr. Fizile. They're going to talk about, they can deal with the division of revenue both, but deal with all of the issues that arise in the context of the municipality and the province. The question was about property rights. And why people in rural areas would have to pay this property rate for the good looking houses. The question of disabled are entitled to a disability grant, which is of the same order, no, it is exactly at the same rate as the old age pension. So the disabled men who are 60, 61, 62, 63, 64 should be entitled to the disability grant, which should be the same. They can't get it twice. The unemployed 60-year-olds, no, it's not possible. We're going to have to phase this thing in, which is why we published the phase-in amount in period in Chapter 6 of the budget review. The Honourable Mashiachu asked what is going to be a very important question in your discussion on division of revenue, the alignment of priorities between national and provinces. She raised a particular question about the license that municipalities may have or may not have to electrify and what happens, and the municipal infrastructure grant, but she withdrew that question because she's waiting for the response on that question from the municipality. Honourable Makosho asked about the municipality's debt. Perhaps, did you want to deal with that?
The issue of that we talked about, that as a municipal level. There's a table in the budget.
Can I ask you to speak more into your mic?
There is a table in the budget review on page 54, table 3.8, and in there it also outlines what local authorities would be following. I think that the point about local authorities meeting their own financing requirements rather than following financing requirements is that, unlike provinces, municipalities have got their competent base. There might be a smaller municipalities which do not have a tax base, but there is a process of the MFMA that if the local authorities have to follow, that they have to follow. So that is what it is. I just want to talk about bonds by the exercise. This was a main predominantly debt exchange. So it's debt for debt. So what you do is that you say I have got R1 billion maturing at the end of 2008. I would rather have this thing mature in 2028. So you offer the investors and say to the investor, anybody who has got my bonds that are maturing in December 2008, I will buy those bonds from you at this price. Show me at what price will you buy my new bonds at 2028. Alternatively, you could say to them, I have got these new bonds that I want to sell in 2028. For you to get these bonds, show me what you can sell the bonds that mature in 2008. Theoretically, that is supposed to be cash reserve, which means that there will be no cash that exchange there. Now, what would have been the impact on the fiscal account? We did one such exercise with an international bond last year, and it was also done in a cash neutral way. The impact on the fiscal will only be felt over the next 15 years. And the reason why it is so is that the debt that we bought there had very high coupons. It was debt that we entered into around 1997. Some of the bonds were done in 1999. Some were done in 2000. And so we offered the investors new bonds maturing in 15 years from last year, and we bought back those bonds that we issued around 1999. Minister asked us, how did you convince them to sell this debt to you? Did you take them in the dust maybe and took the bonds from them? What we actually paid for them was that South Africa is an improving credit. So we offer you an opportunity. You can hold on to your old bonds that would mature in the next 2 years or so. Or we offer you an opportunity. We are an improving credit, so you can buy into the future. We can give you bonds, we can sell you bonds maturing in 15 years' time. And the investors were quite ready to do that. So rather than meet the three, they chose to make a 15 year investment.
Thanks. Francis Thomas will come back on a few later issues, and then I'll probably pick up the other one.
Thank you, Minister Chair. Just 2 points to make, bear in mind on the fuel levy. Of course, the first is that it does serve an environmental purpose, in that there are negative externalities or spillover costs to using fuel on the environment, so it does serve that very important purpose. Second point is that if you look at the percentage that the fuel taxation makes up of the pump price, in fact extremely low by international standards. In Asian countries that goes as high as 70% tax burden on the pump price. And if you look at the table on page 69, you'll see we're significantly lower than that. And then one last point which is made in the budget review, and that is that the increase in the fuel levy is below the rate of inflation. So there has been cognizance of the fact that we obviously don't want to push here too hard, but that it is necessary to keep making increases so that we don't fall too far behind on the target increases on the fuel.
Thanks,
Chair.
Let me try and pick up some of the others. Some of us are nervous about flights now. The unresolved issues that the Honourable Mokoso raised are quite fundamental. I mean, I wish I had an answer for what's happening in education. And colleagues would be aware that it's a concern we share. And the question is not different to Honourable Michelle's question. How do you effect alignment in the allocation? We work with provinces, we indicate how we think the money should be spent. How do you effect the alignment? And how do you monitor that process through? That's the first part of it. The second part of it is, with the money in place, what happens? Now, I have perhaps too simplistic a view on some of these things. But money is only a part of the education equation. We need sound management at the institution that oversees, that firstly recruits the appropriate teachers, secondly sees that they are in class, teaching on time, every day, that manages when the books are delivered to ensure that teaching can start on the first day of school. Management that is accountable, having to be accountable to the local community, to the school governing board. Those kinds of issues are vital. You can't run an education system merely by printing new syllabi sitting in Victoria. It's the local content that makes the difference. Without that management in place, I don't think that we see the appropriate changes to education. I would take exactly the same approach to health. I mean, I've been in situations where local people have been so affected by bad service that of their own volition they form health committees that oversee what happens. And these aunties would walk into a day hospital, a clinic or so on, and say to the nurses, why are you watching the bold and the beautiful? Why aren't you doing your ward rounds? And those facilities are actually functioning much better. If you want democracy to work, then ensuring that there's an adequate financial resource is only the beginning. It's getting all of the other elements in place that I think drive the change, and that's what we have to continue to hold out for. That is why MPs who are on the ground through their constituency offices and connected through community organizations is so important. And there was a reference in the speech yesterday to the fact that part of our mission for the future is one in which community organizations would be there alongside government in the delivery of service. This is a fundamental belief system, and one that we must have in place, because, you know, freedom doesn't come without responsibility. On the PPP's 2 points, there is, of course, the graph on page 36, which picks up in the budget review, that picks up on the private sector versus public investment. Secondly, I mean, there are a number of big investments planned, Anglo Coal, Vodacom fixed line, some chemical plants, and new platinum plants, and they add up to a heck of a lot of money over a long period of time for this new infrastructure development. It's there, the base might not be broad enough, and that's what we have to work towards. That is why discussions around industrial policy are so important. The chair of one of the chairs of the Joint Budget Committee chair has asked about whether we're winning the war on the tax. Now, I know the title of minister is a nice one, but there are other ministers who are better at fighting sin than me. I don't know that we declared war on this matter, but it's an exercise It's an excise tax that we levy on non-essential goods. That's the approach to take it. I mean, you know, now there may be some people for whom alcohol and tobacco is a very essential good. There might be some people for whom alcohol and tobacco is a very essential bad. But, you know, be that as it may, no, it's not. In fact, if France were to take, France Tomasek were to take the same discussion forward in respect of alcohol and tobacco products that it took to fuel, the first point that he would make is that our tax incidence is incredibly low by international standards. This is a discussion we've had. We've looked at tobacco. We've analyzed this thing. I learned about all kinds of stuff from the study. There's a smuggling index. If your price pops above a particular level, it actually pays somebody to take the risk of smuggling in. And then instead of having a controlled environment where you can collect taxes and have some order, firstly they smuggle goods into the country, and secondly they smuggle goods that are filled with bad chemicals that kill people after a very, very, very short time. So we have a responsibility to deal with this. Even between ourselves and the health ministry, there is an agreement, they would say, treble the tax. But, you know, once you've opened a route for smuggling, then other bad things come in as well. So, yeah, you've got to try and take a balance view, and I think the balance was evident in all of the budget. But, you know, other people, you know, those who preach on Friday, Sunday, Saturday, and so on, let them continue to work as sinners. We will tax for as long as we can. I think that's a useful social compact. Thank you.
My co-chair here says that the minister, in a sense, says that whilst others fight the sin, you take advantage of the sin.
In Afrikaans idiom, they say the answer to it is the other's good.
Yeah, well, I think we've exhausted the questions, Minister. And, I want to thank you for appearing before us. I know it's not the end of the process. We are going to be continuing, and the telecommunities are going to be doing the same. I think we've dealt with this part of it. But this morning, some commentators, Minister, attributed the fall of our currency to your announcement of the relaxation of the exchange control. I don't know whether you responded to that, but that's what I saw. But also, there is currently, you mentioned in the speech that the ZFA, as we all know, would soon be announcing the new poverty line. But amongst the things that ZFA is seized with also is also the issue of the new basket of goods for measuring inflation. What would be the impact of the new basket to the current target? Would it move the target? What would it do to the market?
Chair, on the exchange rate, I think the DG showed me a graph, and there was actually very heavy selling hours before the budget speech without any link from any lockup. So it's pretty clear that we were subjected to speculative attacks yesterday. Because you can see the movements hour by hour throughout the day. We were subject to very heavy speculative attacks. The problem is always that when people are caught up, they try and justify their irrational behavior by something. Now, you are a player in the market, and then you say,
why did you behave so badly? Then you say, actually, you know, I've always wanted exchange controls to be taken. But didn't you issue a statement last week saying the one view you have is that the Minister of Finance would lift exchange controls in the budget and say, yes, but that was last week. Yeah, I think that fortunately in a house like this we can have rational discussions about it. Chair, there are a number of tasks that set as a have to conclude within the space of the next few weeks. One of them is clearly the poverty line, which is a very close, very intensive study and debate that the Treasury has been quite involved with as well. A number of academics. This is something we alluded to in the budget last year, and now we've got to bring this one together. So the release is scheduled for the next few weeks. There's a second piece of work which relates to the report of the income and expenditure survey, which was concluded
end of 2006,
which changed the methodology that was premised on the diary method and so on, and that should be released within the next few weeks as well. And then, but I think you, in sequencing terms, you need to know the content of the income and expenditure survey in order to then have a platform for rational discussion about the basket for inflation measures. So it's going to be a tough few weeks for statistics. I will try and get the schedule of releases and perhaps ask how to engage with the committee. And through those who are in there, ensure that you have the information.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, he is appearing before the commission on the 7th of March on the income and the expenditure bill. Yeah. Thank you very much. Thanks, members, Mr. Treasury. I know the MSCSP is eager to get on to it. Thanks, Commissioner. We are going to break for tea for 10 minutes and return and deal with
How did you respond to your
Did I give you a copy of the previous presentation of the minister's presentation?
He didn't really go through the budget thing, did he?
No.
He just said we did a rich
thing. But I've got extra copies.
If you have, that's a super thank you.
Who is the FFC's parliamentary liaison?
these are relevant because this is the essentially parliamentary land which is parliamentary there. Okay. We are now for the time. We are all yours for the time. Okay.
Thank you, Chairman, and thank you for the opportunity you have allowed us to make this presentation today. This submission is made in terms of the Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Act of 1997, Section 214(1) of the Constitution. It is a result of extensive consultations between the Commission and government through the National Treasury, the Budget Council, and the Budget Forum. And as you have indicated, Chair, we are responding to the Division of Revenue Bill, and we are going to make comments on changes to the 2007 Division of Revenue Act.
Sure.
And then we also make comments on the framework of specific grants as detailed in the accompanying schedule. And we'll also comment on Annex E with respect to allocations to provinces and municipalities, and we'll present the Commission's comments on the government's response as well. What our process will be to ask Bongani Kumalo to make a presentation, and then thereafter Commissioner Adam and myself, and when necessary, Mr. Bongani will respond as questions are up. So, Chair, I will then ask Bongani.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. One of us, thank you. Okay, very quickly through the presentation. There are a few changes that we picked up in the field compared to what we seen last year. I think most of the changes basically that we picked up are those changes that the Commission supports as they seem to be those changes that are aimed at deepening the scheme of fiscal decentralization and also deepening issues around accountability and sensitizing the system to provide quite detailed information around transfer. So basically introduces quite a lot of transparency in the system. Now, with respect to the municipal infrastructure plan, we picked up the fact that now those municipalities that do not have capacity, as opposed to in the past where the grant would be transferred, the grant would be transferred to a category C municipality. That is no longer going to be the case. And the grant will go directly to that municipality and then some intervention in case of failure. Is actually provided for. So this clause basically strengthens the concept of targeted capacity building within the municipalities by relevant provincial and national government departments where there is such capacity building. Now, with respect to clause 16, we still need to have
Can I just check here, Mr. Kumar? On the presentation here on the slide, it says that the provision that where a category B municipality does not have capacity, the MIG is transferred through the category. It should actually be the C.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What we picked up was that there's quite a confusing wording in respect of subsection 2 in that clause. I think if I were to read it in the version of the bill that I have, which I put yesterday, it basically reads this way. It says the transferring national officer must transfer the house, train, rapid training allocation to the bank account designated for transfer in the dedicated banking account configuration established for the transfer of the house, train, rapid training allocation in accordance with the directive issued by the National Treasury under Section 10(2). So, trying to understand that, we basically felt that it is very difficult to understand what this wording basically means. We probably are not legal experts, and probably there is a legal dimension to it that is probably are not speaking, but we think that the wording is quite convoluted and it seems to lose one in terms of meaning. What it picks up as well is that in clause 17 there was a provision for the accreditation of municipalities with respect to the housing or integrated human settlement grant. What we picked up is that this clause that required municipalities to be accredited has been removed from the bill. And the commission is of the view that the principle that the delivery of housing be closest to where the people are, which is at the municipal level, where municipalities have capacity, should actually be maintained. And in fact, since the Commission first made this recommendation on accreditation, I think it was in 2005, the Commission has been following closely the progress with respect to this particular implementation of this particular clause, and currently is basically carrying out some work to look at how many municipalities have actually been accredited thus far, and what sort of challenges are there with respect to the implementation of this particular clause. I think one of the key issues that is actually happening is that the pace of accreditation is happening very slowly. And so the Commission intends to make certain proposals around this matter in its submission for the 2009 Division of Service, which will be tabled, I think, in May, end of April, sometime in May, something. So basically, the Commission is of the view that the section that deals with the accreditation should be retained in the future, and in fact should not have been removed. With respect to the issue around the World Cup, clause 18, which deals with the World Cup, FIFA World Cup grant, the Commission also welcomes the relatively stringent requirements that have been added for dealing with cost overruns. In fact, the Commission proposes that the clause be inserted to the effect that when budgets are exceeded, sound reasons must be provided to make this consistent with some of the provisions that are attached to grant transporting results. For example, the municipal infrastructure grant regulation is quoted with respect to that process. Clause 31 basically has quite a number of requirements for provincial treasuries that must accompany the tabling of budgets by provincial treasuries. And those requirements those provisions that have been added to this clause basically are also supported by the Commission in the respect of, as I mentioned earlier, that most of the changes to the Act, to the 2007 Act, basically try to move the system a step forward in terms of increased transparency, and also to try and align some of the grants in terms of the program from an institutional point of view. I think the committee would recall that sometime, I think around about 2006, the Commission made a recommendation with respect to trying to find a linkage between the municipal infrastructure grant on the one hand and the housing subsidy allocation formula, so that the rollout of municipal infrastructure is in tandem with the delivery on housing on the other side. Now, the discussions that happened between ourselves and the National Treasury basically indicated that from a technical point of view, that would be very difficult to actually achieve that lead to link those two formulas technically. Now, what seems to be happening here is that there is the fact that you need to make those allocations very upfront, very clear what they're going to be per municipality as well. Over a 3-year period, basically it indicates that it gives some certainty in terms of planning on this kind of project, and therefore the Commission actually welcomes it. Now, also, the requirement that provincial treasuries gazette the allocations when they table their budget is also welcomed, and the Commission basically proposes that over and above the gazetting, this information should also be published in the major newspapers and also on the websites of the relevant departments, so that those people that don't have access to government gazette would be able to also find a way of accessing that information. Now, with respect to government's response to the FSC's recommendation, the general observation is that there is a convergence or a meeting of views with respect to most of the recommendations that were tabled. There are, however, certain areas where there are a few differences that we picked up. I will start with the focus basically is on those areas where we identify certain differences. We're not going to dwell on those areas where there are general agreement. Now, the first one where there's a difference basically, which is not a big issue, is with respect to addressing the legacy effects of the 2010 FIFA World Cup. Now, the FSC proposed that government needs to set up an agency to deal or to address those legacy effects. Now, government is of the view that there are sufficient institutions, basically, that will be able to deal with those legacy effects. Now, the Commission basically was not really married on the idea of an agency, but the idea was to sensitize the system to the need to institutionalize the way in which those legacy effects are actually dealt with, especially where they move across spheres of government. So basically, I don't think that in principle the Commission has any issue with government's response in this respect, so long as there is a realization of that those legacy effects might need some intervention from the national government point of view in terms of changing them. Then it's probably okay. Now, with respect to the school nutrition program, the Commission basically made a recommendation which was probably read to imply that the Commission is suggesting that the school nutrition program needs to be extended to secondary schools. But in fact, the recommendation was not about extending or not extending the program, which was about the feasibility of extending that program. The work that the FSC did basically indicated that it was feasible to extend the program, but in carrying out that work, which was a specific request from the Select Committee on Finance to investigate that feasibility, the FSC then stumbled upon other other issues that were presenting problems in terms of implementing that program. So the recommendation was that while it was feasible to extend the program, that extension should not be considered unless certain conditions have been addressed. And those covered problems that were identified at both the national department level and at the level of the provinces. And I think those are details in the submission itself. So basically, in principle, again here, the Commission is of the view that there are no significant differences. In fact, what government says is that no decision has been taken with regard to extending the program. And I think these tend to be areas where there's a blurring of the lines in terms of to what extent can the FLC make pronouncements around those kinds of issues and to where does the FLC mandate actually stop. And here I think if one considers this to be a policy issue, then obviously it might mean that it's outside the scope of the FLC's mandate. I don't think that there's a problem in principle. With respect to road transport infrastructure, there was a recommendation around this which basically was to the effect that whilst we review the provincial official share formula, which is an exercise that the FLC is currently undertaking or coordinating as it were, there would be a need to investigate whether introducing some indicative components in the provincial equitable share formula to deal with funding for transport, especially at the level of the provinces, especially to ensure that sufficient resources are allocated to the maintenance of the road infrastructure in the provinces. That is an issue. Now, government response basically cautions against the use of the formula to target allocation for such issues in transport infrastructure. And this basically is probably born out of past experiences with such kinds of components. I mean, the history tells us or teaches us that at some point we had a backlog component in the provincial equitable share formula, but that backlog component never actually addressed the backlog that we were talking about. So putting that money through that formula might not necessarily guarantee that there would be improvement in terms of spending on infrastructure maintenance. Now, the Commission basically notes this response and basically will be taking it into account as it reviews the provincial infrastructure formula. Now, with respect to other issues that basically arise in Annexa E, one key issue that we picked up relates to the conditional grant. So we picked up that the conditional grant has a share of total transfers to provinces increased by 1% since the 2006-2007 fiscal year. We've had some discussions about the sources of this, but the point that still remains is that one must be very careful about the way in which we subtract the transfer. Basically, if we increase the amount of conditional grant, then it somehow could be at the expense of the provincial equitable share formula, where provinces expected to have a little bit of more flexibility in terms of how they then implement their budget. But there could be other reasons for this. But it's just a flag that the Commission would like to raise around this. There is also some grants that when we were discussing them, for example, in the new conditional grant for property rates and the responsibility for building trips to the provinces, then we create the position of grant to deal with the property rights responsibilities of provinces. Now, unfortunately, in the framework, there's no specification as to how long this grant will actually be in place for. One would want to assume that once that function is shifted to the provinces, then it becomes a day-to-day business of the province to make sure that they actually take care of their responsibilities with respect to paying or covering those property rates. And one would expect that this grant would sooner than later be phased into the equitable share. So we would have loved to see certain time frames basically associated with this grant. Yeah. I think there's also some issues that come up from in Annexa E that relate to what is happening with respect to the local government fiscal framework. There is some work that the government is undertaking with respect to placement of RSD levels, with respect to the restructuring of the electricity distribution industry, all of which have certain implications for local government revenue. The commission is also conducting its own work around those issues, and the next forthcoming submission will also be tabling certain recommendations around this issue. This is basically what
Thank you, Chair. I think I'll continue.
That takes us to the end of the submission. I would like us now to take National Treasury so that we don't have questions on issues that National Treasury might have perhaps responded to. And then we will take questions on both the submissions. And I then request that Mr. Brown and Mr. Sergio of the kind that the provision in the
act have always thought doesn't happen. Only level one, that level one accreditation, which has been a bit more basic, that has been achieved. But that doesn't mean that accreditation of municipality for housing will not happen, because it isn't provided for in any event in the Housing Act of 1997. That's the one point to make. But the second point to make is that in the clause that provides for preparations for the future year, there is a provision that requires that provinces, provincial departments of housing should work with the municipalities that will be identified, 18 of them, to make sure that they can arrive at a set of allocations for those municipalities for the next 3 years, which would then give those municipalities a lot of certainty in terms of the allocation for the housing grant that will be spent within their jurisdiction. And it is hoped that that should allow those municipalities to prepare themselves for receiving the money in the event that they happen to be in member region. But also the preparation then will entail identifying land for the housing facility and laying out the infrastructure that will be necessary to such a basis for it. But that also giving a certain to take the quite forward. In that case, if that step can be taken, it will then begin to lay a basis for a faster process of accreditation in the future, whether provided for only in the Housing Act or maybe in subsequent division of building bills and death acts. Then the other new provision that has been inserted in this bill is the requirement that entities that undertake functions on behalf of national departments or provinces should be required to submit a report on the amount that they would have received in any financial year and the expenditure on the amount that has been transferred to them, which would then be submitted to the Treasury as part of the routine reporting that's required in terms of the Public Finance Management Act. And this is to make sure that at least government and parliament are aware of how much money at any given time has been transferred to these entities, and of the money transferred to them, how much of it has been spent at any given time. Now, with respect to the municipality or the municipal infrastructure grant, there is a requirement to also ensure that there is reporting on non-financial performance, so to begin to move beyond just looking at money and expenditure as an indicator of what has happened, because the money costs to buy something, and we hope that we'll be able to then get the information and it will be in use before. In his comment, the FFC has made reference to the change, minor change that has been added to 2010, which is intended really to ensure that once the costing are known and they can be firm and the debate throughout the period about whether the amount are enough or not is not sort of lingering all the time. A lot of confusion and unnecessary moment. Now the other very useful addition to the bill is the requirement that provincial treasuries should publish in their documentation information relating to allocation where money is intended to end up in municipalities, schools and hospitals. Again, the idea is proposing that perhaps to go further to the just publication of the newspaper. The view that we had taken, at least in the bill, was to say officially, it could suffice in this environment that such allocation is gazetted, which would help in taking the system a step forward in terms of both transparency, but as well as accountability in terms of just enabling communities to monitor what happens, because these people know that a particular school, hospital, or municipality is earmarked to receive a certain amount of money, then they can check, and if it's for what people, they can also check whether the money has indeed arrived and whether it has made a difference after it arrived. At the request of a number of national departments, there is a clause inserted to just emphasize the fact that departments that are responsible for concurrent functioning can institute the process of intervening, especially for programs that are funded through earmarked allocation, to the extent that they would be there might be a failure in a program, to make sure that the delivery of the service is targeted and delivered through those funds can still take place. I've made the assumption to talk about that issue.
Thank you, Mr. Fuzi. Thanks. I'll quickly bump up to run through how the ballot structure, what are the main issues. Actually, in there, and touch on some of the formulae and issues that are quite important for the division of revenue itself. As you all know, it's a Section 76 bill that needs to serve in basically both houses. There are 49 clauses, basically in the bill, 7 schedules, and what is attached in the bill is a memo on objectives, and then what is important is there's an explanatory memorandum. Now, in previous years, we published it with a budget review. Currently, it's attached there as W1 in the bill there. Then in there are appendices, W2 and W3, which provide for a conditional grant framework, all the conditional grants that are in the system. Each of them have got the framework basically there. And then W4 to W8 basically provide for all the allocations of all grants basically going to 2 municipalities over the next 3 years. The schedule 1 of the bill is the division of revenue basically between the 3 spheres. 2 covers the equitable share among the 3 among the 9 provinces. 3 gives an indication of each municipality's equitable share. Schedule 4 is other transfers to provinces and municipalities that are supplementing programs that are funded from own sources there. Then Schedule 5 are specific allocations to provinces. 6 specific purpose allocations to municipalities. And 7 would be in-kind transfers that are made then to municipalities. Chapter 7 and 8 of the budget review really goes in quite a bit of detail on the priorities of government, all the key policies that inform the division of revenue there, and also all the allocations that are going to provinces and municipalities, and the priorities that underpin basically those allocations there. And as I said, an extra W1 of the division of revenue bill itself provides quite a bit of detail on each of those allocations there. Now, the annexure, which is the explanatory memorandum to the division of revenue bill, deals with the division of revenue between the 3 spheres. It provides the response, government's response to the FFC's recommendations. It provides for provincial allocations, municipal allocations, and it concludes with further work that will be undertaken by government on provincial and local government fiscal matters there. Then appendices W2 and 3, basically as I've indicated, are those conditional grant frameworks. Now these ones will be gazetted within the first 2 weeks after the bill really takes effect, and we hope that by the 14th, basically, of April, that these frameworks
will then be presented. In this framework, we have measurable objectives, the conditions, the allocation criteria for each grant, the performance of these grants, financial and non-financial, and the issues that need to be taken into account when planning is made for the next financial year, the responsibilities for national departments, and what we've added actually in the housing, in the integrated housing and human settlement one, is specifically the roles and responsibilities of Tubedisha Home, because we've discovered quite large numbers of money that's actually transferred to that public entity for housing development. And then there's a matter of providing regular reports there. Then 4 to 8 of the annexure provides local government allocations for municipality, all the allocations basically going to municipalities, and these are reflected both in the municipal and in the national financial year. And W8 would then provide a thorough kind of breakdown of how much money is pure equitable share, how much of that is replacement grant for the RSC levy, and what is provided for councillor remuneration there. Now let me turn to the provincial equitable share formula itself. For this round, the structure of the formula remains unchanged, and as the FSC I think indicated, there is a review currently underway on this formula, and it is led mainly by the FSC there. So for now the structure remains unchanged, and will hopefully whatever comes out from the work of the FSC will inform how we then proceed with the formula. What we've done though for this MTF is to update the formula with the latest available information. In this case we've updated it for the 2007 community survey. We've updated it with the 2007 education snapshot survey, which covers actual enrollment in schools. We've updated it with the 2006 general household survey and the GDPR for 2005. Now, unlike last year where we had quite a bit of a structural change because of the demarcation, government at the time said, look here, this is quite a change that can't be phased in because the boundaries have changed. This time around, because of these changes, we again revert back to our proposal that the impact of the data update actually be phased in, and we show the phase in percentages and everything basically there. Just to give you an idea, the committee an idea, this table will then show the 2007 MTF weighted shares in the Eastern Cape, for example, 15.8. After we've affected now the adjustment or updated the formula with the latest available data, the weighted shares are going down to 15.6 in the case of the Eastern Cape, which is a reduction in the weighted share of 0.2% to ensure stability in the budgets of provinces over the MTF. A decision by government really was taken to phase this in, and I think the next slide will then show how that phase in is then implemented over the next 3 years there. The next slide just shows all the allocations, or at least the provincially equitable share allocations, and one will see that over the MTF, all of them are really growing quite substantially despite those particular updates that are being made there. Now, some of the work that we will be undertaking in the years ahead relates to the differentiated approach to municipal infrastructure development. I think if one starts to think about it, the worldwide trend that a lot of people are now moving actually to our larger urban centers and placing quite greater demand on municipal infrastructure basically within these urban centers. And worldwide trends in cities is really to have a long-term view on city planning for that matter. And it is a question, are we as South Africa also following that trend? Shouldn't we also now think of long-term kind of planning so that
we deal with whatever rigidities that are currently in the system, where you've got people, particularly our low-income people, staying far outskirts basically of our city centers, and to see how we integrate a lot of that with proper transport facilities and everything, and do actually quite a bit of integrated planning on that. And we are busy with work around that particular kind of approach there. I think that in chapter 4 of the budget review, where we start to talk about the replacement for RFC levies, and where we're talking about probably devolving parts of the fuel levy to municipalities, so that's how that will work. We're going to spend basically this year to finalize that for implementation probably in the next budget. Then is the matter of funding poorer municipalities. I think this year the equitable share and, for that matter, the municipal infrastructure grant was specifically revised to take into account how we deal with the plight of poorer municipalities there. We have adjusted the MIG formula basically to take into account for that. I'll talk to that a bit later. On the local government equitable share formula, when we looked at how it could affect it, then we discovered quite a bit of variables within the formula itself that work against each other. With the result, it was a bit difficult for now to implement that there, but we will be reviewing the formula and see how we can actually make it quite a bit redistributed towards poorer municipalities there. This slide, basically W1.4, just shows basically the funds or the additional funds made to the three spheres of government, and we continue to see that there's a greater bias again towards our pro-poor programs there, and the fact that a large chunk of this goes to municipalities and provinces, and they are the government that actually then implement government's pro-poor policies there, shows that bias towards that. Then this table just gives a snapshot of the division of revenue itself, and if one starts to look at the shares at the bottom for 2008-9 to 2010-11, one will see that about 50.5% of the budget really goes to provinces and to municipalities over the period. And if one takes into account what is the national department, is your social assistance grant, which runs actually already in the order of about 80 or so billion, then one can see that quite a bit of a proper front in the entire budget there. The division of revenue in this one, now this shows what you will see, national part being large there, is all the conditional grants basically that will flow to provinces and municipalities is scored in this case at national there. Then on the response on the FSC's proposal, we are undertaking work that around the local government fiscal framework, around provincial fiscal framework, and our response basically also takes into account the work that is ongoing and that we're doing. Now, these proposals were discussed at the Budget Council. They were discussed at the Budget Forum. Incidentally, I think this year, except for a little bit on the World Cup, little of the proposals have any bearing to municipalities there, and these have been endorsed now by cabinet there. And I don't want to basically just repeat what the FSC and my colleague basically as indicated there, but where we disagree, the issue around the agency for us to provide some kind of reasons basically for that. We are of the view in any case that a lot of the legacy impacts of the World Cup are of a local nature
for that matter. And I think this is the part where we agree with everybody, that the local government themselves can be in a position to manage quite a bit of that. If a municipality wants to build a fair park and all of that, and it falls within its jurisdiction, it can look basically in managing that bit. But I think for where one is sitting, is establishing an agency is just leads to a proliferation of these public entities there. And later you'll find that once the World Cup is over, we need to find further reasons to keep some of these public entities there, which is the problem. And I think when we go to our housing entities administered by the housing department, there's a typical example of these entities there. So we are of the view that there are current systems that can deal with some of these legacy impacts there. On the school nutrition program, I don't think that the FSC is really saying that in its recommendation that needs to be really shifted to secondary school, but just on its way to there. Government's view on this is, let's fix, in line with the proposal that the FSC is making, let's fix the current system. And once we fix the system, then we can gradually then start to phase it into our secondary school there. No decision on that has been made yet, and if a decision is made, all of that will have to compete with other priorities and act in government there. Then the rest of the recommendations, as indicated, we're basically singing from the same hymn sheet, I hope, on that. Then on the provincial allocations, basically what the W1.6 shows is for 2008 and 2009, the equitable share that goes to provinces and all the conditional grants that goes to provinces. I think the one point that the FSC made on conditional grants, that its share is actually growing of transfers. While the share is growing, it doesn't mean there's a lot more conditional grants actually in the system. If one takes into account the adjustments that we make, and I think I've got the slide that will show it, which is the next slide, all the revisions that are actually being made are actually being made to existing grants, just to strengthen them, to roll out that quite more. It doesn't mean there's more. The public works grant that is there, I think we have included now in the framework that it be phased out basically in 3 years' time, once all of that is basically sorted out. But we can, where we are, we can still explore ways that it be phased out sooner, basically. That this slide, as I've indicated, shows basically the revisions that are now made to provincial to conditional grants baseline that are going to provinces there. And this slide will look busy from where you are, shows just a summary of all the conditional grants to provinces that are currently in the system there. On local government, I think what is important here, and I'll talk to a bit of the municipal infrastructure grant issue. Whenever one designs a grant or so, you know, particularly if you're going to divide it across 283 entities or municipalities, you know, we must always find a way to design a formula that is really objective and that ensures certainty. But the emphasis is really on objective, because you know, we received a call 2 or 3 weeks ago from a member of parliament in Limpopo, saying, hey, you know, there's a lot of development going on here in Kabazimbi, and why the municipal infrastructure grant that goes to Kabazimbi so low, and shouldn't it be increased and all of that? Now, you can imagine if you get a similar call from 282 other municipalities, how do you deal with it? How do you decide on who to give and who not to give, basically? And it is within that context that one wants to emphasize the issue around objectivity there. But I think what the Treasury and what we need to do as a collective, basically, is to start to identify some of the municipalities that show greater potential for local economic development and find ways of supporting them. And supporting them does not necessarily mean they must rely on national transfers. Some of them can actually enter the capital market and go and borrow. Actually, one is of the view that they can borrow much more than what they, for example, currently are borrowing. And those are the things that we have to basically look into there. On the local government importable share, as I've indicated, we have not adjusted that at the stage to make it more redistributive, but we are looking into that so that we can still continue to channel more funds towards poorer municipalities there. Now, what we have done with the municipal infrastructure grant was to ensure that at least there's a minimum allocation for each municipality. Now, if the chair can and the members can recall, some of the municipalities in the last Division of Revenue Act were allocated 500,000 for that matter. Others, 1 million for that. And in today's terms, it's up to us, how far can you go, basically, with that? And it was within that context that one is saying probably we need to think about a minimum allocation, but we need to do it through a formula. We can't do it outside of a formula. Now, what we've done with the municipal infrastructure grant formula was we have added a constant, basically, element onto it, where we, in year one, every municipality will get 2.2 million, and what then remains is basically divided through the formula. Incidentally, in year one, a lot of the allocations of those few municipalities are actually jumping to about 3.2-3.3 million. In year two, they get already about the 5 million that we intended to have, and in year three, they get close to 6 million. Also, why we wanted to introduce this is to have a continuous growth for those particular municipalities. What we were worried about was they will probably now remain at 5 million throughout. Now, what we want is to see some kind of steady growth for those poor municipalities. Then, on the transfers to local government, this slide basically just summarizes all of the transfers that are made to local governments. I think about 6.5 or so through the equitable share, a large chunk through the provincial, through the municipal infrastructure grant. In fact, it's about 3.8 billion there. Our public transport infrastructure and system grant is 2 billion, and we note the recommendation that the FFC is making around the future of how we will deal with this. Normal practice is to phase these into the equitable share, but I think we need to have some kind of a vision on beyond 2010. How do we deal with public transport? Not only, incidentally, this grant is not only for the whole city, but it's for all cities and all a number of other municipalities as well. But it's a question of once after 2010, how do we deal with public transport infrastructure and rolling it out to all other municipalities in quite a bit of aggressive way there. So that will also inform how we proceed with that there. On the World Cup, we are adding about the 1.2 billion, and this brings government commitment, basically, or contribution to the World Cup in terms of the construction of stadiums to about 9.6 billion there. And the rest are current transfers. As the members will know, in 2009, next year, we will be hosting the Confederation Cup before the World Cup. So part of the money is gradually for the operational cost to allow the host cities to host the actual event itself there. Then this table basically summarizes the entire transfers that are being made to local government over the next 3 years. There, 21, right, 1.21 just summarizes the conditional grants and the different grants that are actually going to municipalities. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Atoskri National Treasury. I'll then open it to members to ask questions. I'm just trying to find, I don't know whether I missed it. There was another area where I think it was 16 that the FFC raised that there is a confusion in the wording of subsection 2. I don't know how I missed it. If I missed it, can you just draw my attention to how you responded to that one?
The sentence or the clause is quite long, so it does run the risk that when one reads it, the one might stumble. But I also want to suggest or submit that part of the risk is that for people who probably read it, other than those, say, in Treasury, National Department of Transport, Accountant Treasury, and the Provincial Department of Transport in Accountant, it might be just hard one of the reasons the problem, because the clause is not that meant for those things. Essentially, what this clause arises from is the fact that for housing, the housing lending allocation, there is a co-funding arrangement between national government and the government. And therefore, to make sure that between the two of them, at any given point in time, they know how much each sphere contributed to the expenditure relative to their share contribution, there is a separate sub-account in the account configuration to make sure that in that account, then only money that relates to Caltrain goes in. The province's portion and national government's portion. And then the expenditures are then recorded against that. Now, if somehow then in the wedding things get lost, perhaps there might be a need to relook it, but from our discussions with the relevant parties that are supposed to understand it, none of them sort of raise the thing that what exactly do we want us to do here, or be expected to do, or are we expected to do in the sense of this?
Yeah, I think that's what I also find missing, because I don't get the recommendations from the SFC as you are expected to do. All you're saying is that it's confusing, and it might need a clearer way. Maybe it should be useful if we were to look at what then are you recommending? FFC? What do you recommend we do with it? I know on some of the issues you said you are not married to them, and I would not want us to go to those, like the issue of the school's nutrition program, and you said you're not married to them, but you're cousin. And on the other one, you explicitly said that you will be making a recommendation in 2009. I want us here to come out with something that we are all satisfied that at least it addresses your concern. We know your concern, we want your recommendation.
Yeah, I don't know, we did look at that thing, that clause, and we thought we didn't understand it, because that's why we shortened it. But I think maybe the way it explained makes sense.
We can't take Lumisa and keep him in the deal, so that he never comes across it, then you just press the button and Lumisa comes up again.
Okay, I
think it's a very good point, and what I suggest is that we reconsider the wording and make a suggestion sometime later on how to be improved. And just clarify, because I think that the issue is that there are so many ideas conflated into a single sentence that it actually becomes slightly confusing.
Okay, because you know, I want you to help us here, because we would want to finalize the process from the NA side here and pass it on to the NCLT in actually a few minutes from now. That's what we would want to do. So if we, you know, we do not want to run the risk of sending it over to the NCLT only for it to come back to us with an amendment. Because if there is a change in this is not a money problem. This is one bill that we can actually, you know, deal with an amendment here and now if we agree. If you were suggesting something. So the only simplification to this that I could put is to just write it in Zulu.
I think that what was perhaps missing for us was a greater emphasis on the fact that this is a co-funded arrangement with funds coming from national and funds coming from province as well, and that there was a need to actually separate the contributions of these particular funds. So I think that in fact, just instead of referring to the relevant directive, we actually give some indication of the substance of that directive. So we actually, as Natasha has explained it here, we just give a bit more background on the fact that this is a co-funded project, that there are contributions from two spheres, and that the banking configuration, bank account configuration has made allowance for ring-fencing these two separate contributions.
Yeah, I don't know. I want somebody to help me, because you know we are, you know, this clause 16 has just got two sub-clauses. One you are happy with. Two is the one that you said. It says the transferring national officer must transfer the Caltrain rapid rail link allocation to the bank account designated for transfer in the dedicated banking account configuration established for the transfer of Caltrain. A rapid rail link allocation in accordance with the directive issued by the National Treasury under Section 10(2)(a) of the Division of Revenue Act. So let's say something then that will satisfy you in clarifying the conclusion of this show. Like the Minister said, it's quite a long sentence without even a comma. You know, I almost ran out of breath. Because if we cannot do that, I would want us to adopt it as it is, confusing as it is, and I would want people to give me the assurance that we are not going to, this is not going to come up again in the SOPA for it to come back to us. Yeah, that's all I'm trying to do. I understand your concern, but I want us, you know, to close the matter in an amicable manner that leaves all of us satisfied that justice has been done.
Okay, can I
suggest
that specific paragraph on who does that apply? In other words, is that applicable on Treasury, or is that something that is also applicable on housing problems? If it is only applicable on Treasury, then obviously it must be read with the meaning and the intent that it's only meant for housing, for Treasury. And then it's actually irrelevant if there's more contributions towards that project or funding. Or am I wrong in that assumption?
What I'm meant to understand is that it's a co-funded project, both from the Treasury and the province. So, and the effect, you know, the confusion here is that because of that, the funding, there must be some kind of reinvestment for the funds so that they do not, you know, the funds themselves do not find
Thank you, Chair. I was just wondering whether one could add something. The Transferring National Office will transfer the cost of the co-funded Carpe and Rapid Rail Link allocation to the bank account.
Does it in any way go at least go ahead.
Chair, I think it is rather a lengthy sentence, but I want to suggest that that it might be wise to leave it as it is, because it has been worded to provide assurance to the private party lenders who are parties to this transaction, and the rather convoluted routing of the money to a dedicated account is so that there is complete certainty on the part of the concessionaire, who in the end is spending this money and dependent on the claims coming through timely and knowing exactly where and how they can use it. In the end, it's for that reason that there is this rather unusually detailed specification of how the money will flow. Now, I'm quite sure that if we were to spend time on it, we could word it in a grammatically more elegant way, and we could spend a bit of time on that if you would like to. But I think it's perhaps helpful for the committee to understand that the details here is because this is a contract on which the issue of the specific statutory assurance is definitely given.
Okay. Jonathan says that if we leave it as it is, this would be subject to the interpretation that we have just received. And if there's any confusion that arrives, we'll call out the Associated National Treasury. Because I don't think it's just the definition, the understanding of National Treasury, how to. I'd imagine as well, why would the FSP or one dash? I would want that to move on.
The decision in terms of support and promise that has been made now, because as I interpret this, this is something that is applicable in terms of the grant by Treasury in terms of the Gauteng project. So the fact that there is other contributions towards that fund is for this purpose too incidental, because this doesn't regulate that, it regulates this. And obviously I suspect that there must be some other regulations or something that will rule the combined funds and how that gets applied and reported on that as well.
Okay, because it also says that in accordance with the directive issued by the President under Section 10, and if this clause can be interpreted again anywhere else, it would refer to the housing of the trade clause.
Yeah.
Of course. Are you okay?
Okay, thanks.
I
want
to just understand our movement on the same clause. If you check on sentence number 2, you will remove bank account. And also go forward to remove 4, transfer in rest and put end. And then on sentence number 3, remove configuration, replace it with sessions. I think maybe it can be
Your complication is even more. Your complication is even more difficult. Can we agree that we leave the sentence as it is? If we ever see it,
it's in the same. No, we're just going to propose that we perish after the day.
I think the basic principle is that ideally one wants everything to be completely transparent and accessible to the layperson. But as National Treasury has pointed out, because there are certain statutory and other public partnership ramifications that hang on the exact words, one has to do cost-benefit analysis. And under those circumstances, might be appropriate to leave it as it is.
Okay,
but
I agree that we leave it as it is. The members, the division of revenue bill before. Mr. Singh,
Yeah, Chair, thank you. I have some, oh, God, something happening here. I just have some other questions which hopefully they can answer quite quickly. The clauses 15 and 31 of the gazetting and things like that, when is the implementation date? When do provinces have to start implementing? Is it now with this coming year budget that they have to advertise this thing? That's question one. Question two is the property rates, the new conditional grant for property rates. Now, I know at the moment municipalities are going through this whole revaluation of land and property and things like that, and there's a lot of media articles about government not paying property rates to municipalities, and I know Tegmini was saying it's going to place a burden on their own revenues if government doesn't pay. Now, how does this property rates and conditional grant kick in? And then the last question is, I see some of these grants are called specific purpose recurrent grants, then allocations in kind to municipalities. Equitable share, we know what that means, and RSC levy replacement, we know what that means. So what is allocations in kind? That's on W6, and then specific purpose recurrent grants, W4. And will we be able to, at some later stage, if we require the details of these grants that are going to be given to some of these municipalities, to be made available to us as a committee? And what they want it for.
Are there any other questions?
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm the one who wrote the letter and told you about Tabazoo. And it is for the benefit of everybody here, because we respect the Tabazoo's strategy. I think we'd like to share it and also expect the response to pass over to my municipality. And the other question I asked was on alignment of provinces, it's within this context. Second priority.
Yeah, I know Mr. Brown didn't bring the his response. Have you written back to the man?
No, we have written back on that. But let me touch on some of the questions you raised. On the issue around property rights, I think the thing is confusing two things.
Mm-hmm.
This part of the property rights that's covered in here is relates to properties that national government after 1994. Administered some of the properties where it wasn't clear where they were headed, administered the payment of the property rate on behalf of the respective provinces. Now, there's currently quite a bit of an elaborate process that went undertaken to identify which provinces some of these properties belong to and all of that. So it's a large portfolio of properties. Now, we have succeeded in identifying schools and clinics, for example, because those are easier ones to identify. So those ones are now basically the process of actually transferring them to the respective provinces is finalized. Now, what this grant is doing is to say, now that you know that this school falls within your jurisdiction, we have paid for it. Now it is your turn to pay for it. So it's a function shift, basically. Now, this and what you were talking about relates to the property rights regulations, which will also be part of a discussion later in the month or so, or early next month, and how that will impact basically on each and every municipality. Here they talk specifically about a different ratio for business, residential, state-owned entities, and all of that. That discussion is still going to take place. Basically, in-kind transfers. I think what an in-kind transfer is where you have, for example, say the Department of Water Affairs will undertake a particular project in a municipality, and once the project has been concluded, then it actually then transfers basically the entire asset base of that particular project to that municipality. So the money resides with the natural department, the water affairs. They do the work, and then they then transfer their property basically there. And I think in the document there, basically, we've got for each and every grant, including that in-time transfer, we've got the rules basically separated for us. So that is there. On Kambazimbi, as I've indicated, I mean, I have basically responded to one part of it. On the alignment of priorities, if I understand the member basically correctly, there is, we've got what is known as concurrent functions, basically. These are functions that are shared basically by national and provincial governments. And national governments would set the policy and would require provinces basically to implement those policies. And once the division of revenue is crafted, basically the province then prepares its own budget in terms of those particular priorities.
The section 39(1)(c) Roman figure 1 begins to respond to what the honorable member is saying, because he says that the provincial president must also look at the plan, the infrastructure plan of the various departments of the city, and certainly they are aligned with the IDCs of the municipality. Quite a tall order, come to think of it, just the sheer size of the provincial treasury and the number of municipalities in each of the in a province. But to the extent that this matters, when the new development, given its size, a determination can be made that there ought to be a clinic, a school, the provincial treasury is now required in terms of here that it should attack whether the plan of the Department of Education has to begin to respond to the priorities. This is probably not something that can best be done by really legislation. It just requires that cooperative government should really work. The different spheres should find a way and the right time in which to talk about their plan and see how they can align. And perhaps at this point I should just also use this as an opportunity to respond to the bit of the question that I had and understood in respect of in the previous discussion with the minister about the alignment of national priorities and provincial budgets. Practically what happens is that at the executive level, the minister, national minister of finance, would meet with his colleagues in the various sectors, say education and health, all of them. But let's pick those because of their position. They would articulate what their policy priorities for their various sectors in the context of the Minister's Committee on the Budget, which is non-budget. Once those are accepted, and presumably the Minister would have picked them during discussions within the sector meeting, CM for education and the similar sector in health. So which means that governments, at least within the sector, will be aware of the priorities. The priority is not the school, but they are. The Committee of Education the Minister of Education and the Committee of Education, they would have agreed to, then they come to the Minister's Committee on the Budget. But at the same time, the Minister would carry that to the discussion that he has in the Budget Council, which is with the MEC for Finance, who would be responsible ultimately after the division of revenue has been agreed to allocate or influence the allocation of resources within a province. So
theoretically they interface between, not just theoretically, between the sector and the sector department and the finance sector, so to speak. Then when the division of revenue is cast, it takes into account that education is going to have to deliver or no free tools. And lastly, not quite a round figure, this will cost this much. And then the division of revenue that set out, you see here, is informed by that. Now where sometimes the problem arises, and one says problem because there's no better way to describe it, because certain people don't see it quite as a problem in the past, is then in the fact that if the non-fee school's money is going to flow as part of the equitable share of the problem, which is supposed to be an unconditional allocation over which the provincial executive is supposed to then sit and discuss and weigh priorities within the province and say, yes, we're for nothing to, but we also have this and that, and relatively speaking, we think that we can keep this to nothing to, but we also have to keep this and, you know, for that and the other priorities. But then in the eyes sometimes of the National Life Funding Department, you know, the exercise of that discussion sometimes can be used to attack on the side of going too far from what the National Department may have envisioned. And then that creates a problem. In the end, this thing would seem to raise two questions at the practical level. Could it be, first one is this one, I mean, how much of the discussion that is allowed constitutionally to the provinces, you know, is acceptable? There is the law, the provinces exist, therefore the executive, therefore the legislature, their government, they can exercise this decision. But the question is then, at what point is the exercise of those discussions, of that discussion, sort of, to use it as gone too far? And it is fair to even use as having gone too far. But the other issue, which is probably more critical and would sort of be very practical in a way, if it were to be answered, is to say, could it be that there are programs which by their very nature in the system ought to be such that once national government has made a determination that this is a priority that has to be pursued, then there should be also a decision that goes with that says the exercise of provincial discretion on this particular matter is not allowed. In this case, in this case, that then means that the amount becomes a constitutional amount. Now, with the risk of course attendant to that, that you might just have a situation where the preference is to have all the matters being a conditional allocation, which would raise another question about whether the government should exist in the account. It's quite a difficult thing, it's quite difficult for an official like myself.
Then there was, with your permission, I think the section 22 also has covered it. By the fourth, I think it's within 2 weeks after the start of the financial year, they need to be the basics basically for that. And what we do basically with conditional grants is we prepare what is known as a payment schedule. And in many instances, in any case, implementation starts, if you think about it, this would be 1 April. But the payment schedules are designed in such a way that it takes those particular things into account. So April transfer of the funds will take place immediately after those 14 days, informed by the payment schedule.
Yeah, let me ask a simple one. That with municipalities, that category B municipalities that receive infrastructure grants and are also under project consolidation and have serious infrastructure challenges because of growth in those areas, growth in the population, you know, all related growth, whether it's economic growth, whether it's demand for housing, demand for whatever it is. In this case, thinking of Rustenburg Lake in the Northwest, where the municipality would not spend that grant, and it's under project consolidation, which means it has assistance from all the role players that are part of project consolidation. What could be the problem of not spending this grant? And not, I'm not talking about a 1 year issue, but a consecutive year, 3, 4 years, you know, problem. And you still find that they are like, having serious challenges of infrastructure. But the money is there and they're not spending, they're under a project consolidation.
Let's deal with that. But I'm going to request that members, particularly the chair, that members refrain from abusing this platform. They must write letters that may machine and they have constituted projects.
It's a general one.
No, I have a feeling that in particular the municipality are very effective to use the agenda. It's not very general. Maybe the municipality is general itself, but it's one municipality. I think that. Mr. Johnson, so that you can please take responsibility, we still have a lot of work to do.
I'm trying to.
Just a follow up to the question raised by the chair on the same issue of the municipalities submitting their budget. What is the experience now? And see here on chapter 4, page 18, it says municipalities category 3 must submit their budget not later than 14th of April. What are the, do we still have any challenges, major challenges in this regard as municipalities, especially in category 3 and 3?
I think that you were saying that we may not answer the question.
Go ahead, it depends. If you have a response, some would require analysis.
No, because it's kind of a difficult question. I know certain issues about Rustenburg, but not enough specifically to explain it. And there are many municipalities, each one, have a different reason for not working. The mixture of the pure technical issues, they are people, but others, it's not technical issues, and therefore.
Okay. Can I request that a written response be furnished to this matter, both in her capacity as a member of parliament from that area, but also as chairperson of the Joint Budget Committee, because it could also be used as a case study.
On the honourable Johnson's question, the municipalities are now really able to submit the budget. Right? The record is quite impressive. Most of them submit their budget on time. So much so that you may have noticed we published all the several weeks after they have all tabled or passed their budget, a summary of their budget for the next 3 years. Sometime it could be July, August, depending on how long it takes us to receive all of the information from all of them. I mean, the one area that, if I may, we remain not so happy with is in respect to the quality of the forecast beyond year one. I mean, the first year budget and what turns out at the end of the financial year are sort of good budgets in terms of the revenue forecast and the expenditure. But the outer 3 years seem not to be taken that seriously. And for instance, it's not, you do sometimes find municipalities with a capital budget that decreases in one of the 2 outer years. But then when the 2 outer years come, you see that the capital budget goes back again to the level or above the level where it was in the past. So, I mean, credit to them, these things are complex. I suppose they subscribe to the philosophy that says you better promise less and deliver more. If they don't want to favor for the major infrastructure program, we're going to give you everything and then come that time they are unable to do it. They are happy with the fact that they promise less and then come that year they have fund the program and it's budget is big and they deliver.
Okay, so that brings us to the end of this engagement. And we have this 6 piece of legislation. Any objections to this bill being adopted by the committee? The year, yes?
No objections. I can put it close by close, then. Okay?
No objections. If there are no objections, then we're not going to do a close by close.
Or is it not required? Or is it not required in terms of... No.
I therefore read the report. The Portfolio Committee on Finance has been considered and examined the Division of Revenue Bill, Bill 4 of 2008, National Assembly Section 76-1, referred to it and certified by the Joint Checking Mechanism as a Section 76 bill. Report the bill without amendment. Agreed?
Yes.
Agreed. Thank you, members. And thanks, National Treasury. I know this is a very difficult time.
We need to have another
session. And I understand the anxiety because if we don't do this today and now, the FSC is one of the reasons why I was pushing to make sure that child 16 at least we are one. And perhaps in future we might look at refining it, but. You know, the purpose was for us to be able to finalize the
issue
for the debate
or completely.
Yeah.
Because if you come before the House for debate also, then we should be charged members also on our own. But also to say that we received news that the governor of the Reserve Bank launched money. I'm not too sure, I think it came out of this over the weekend, but just to let the commission know it's important that the commission knows about it. That's when I attended the budget yesterday. I was imagining that's the reason why I was protesting yesterday when the demonstration situation. Thank you, members. That brings us to the end of the session. We'll meet you in the next section.